for what you are about to see next, we must enter, quietly, into the realm of genius. Ladies and gentlemen, mesdames et messieurs, Damen und Herren, from what was once an inarticulate mass of lifeless tissues, may I now present a cultured, sophisticated man about town. Hit it!
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes, or cutaway coat, perfect fits. Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper. Come, let's mix where Rockefellers walk with sticks, or Rumbarellers in their midst.
Minutes after the hour of one, and this the month of December, the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along and making a part of your listening day. Live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milkpacking district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, from where all good things derive. My chums, my pals, mi amigos, mi compadres, my fellow travelers on the road of yucks. This is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It is 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. If you would like to get involved, get on board, get integrate yourself, intersect with the program, if you'd like to merge with us comedically and intellectually speaking, it's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. With your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings, recipes, observations, natterings, goings on. Just random gibberish that you found in the floor drain of your mind. What is it? What, you know, I mean, it's the end of the year. We're wrapping it up. We're getting ready to clear out 2010. So this is the just send it all our way. You can also text if you like via Skype. That is Rick Emerson Show. That's our username on Skype, Rick Emerson Show. Text box on the website is up and running right now. And let's see. What else? Oh, and email. If you want to email, if you're still one of those sad, sad folks that communicates via long-form text, you can do that. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Dawn Taylor, you can be reached as well. That's Dawn, D-A-W-N.
Indeed.
Does that go right to your iPhone?
Yeah.
Excellent.
I've got my...
You have all your emails going there now.
Yeah.
All right. So all of your many, many addresses, they funnel into this one magical device on your hip.
Yes.
Excellent.
In fact, I'm looking at it right now.
Send her something right now, won't you? Maybe something with a big leering clown face licking a knife.
Well, I did just a few minutes ago while you were trying to print that document, I shared with the people on the Facebook what you said about trying to print the mother effing document and then that it was effing absurd.
Yeah.
And somebody said, ooh, sounds like Rick's working glue. And Thomas Gill popped in to say, oh, yeah, no, when he's not, like, on the air, at least on his show anyway, he's the most profane man I've ever met.
I really am relentlessly profane. But the thing is that, like, I just... And, you know, and I know a lot of people really struggle with that. I know a lot of people struggle with it. They get on the microphone and they have to, even radio people, they have to tone it down. You know, or they have to run everything through a filter and you can sometimes hear people hesitate because they'll have to switch everything down into radio friendly mode. And then there's like, you know, like we talked to Court and Bobby about this. We're like, with those guys, Court apparently, especially because I thought it would be difficult for him. I thought that he would have a problem of the two of them. Turning the profanity back on because, you know, they do a very coarse and crude kind of broadcast.
Yeah, but if you ever heard them when they were doing the on-air and off-air stuff, where they were still on KUFO, but they would leave the mic running during songs and stuff. Court just will flip back and forth between swearing and not swearing at a moment's notice and seems to have no problem with it at all.
And see, and for me, it's just the opposite. It's like, you know, but I think it has a little bit to do with my personality that I am kind of so OCD about things that it's just sort of an all or nothing kind of proposition. So that's why we do have pretty... I mean, they're not really written down, but you sort of internalize them over time, kind of hard and fast rules about what, you know, what gets dumped and what doesn't and what you can say and what you can't. But I compensate by just swearing like a truck driver. Just every moment that I'm not here. I mean, I use words that are so vile that I sometimes, but the thing is, I use them so frequently that they lose their punch to me and I forget exactly how crude I can be. Like, I will use the C word just at a moment's notice. But the thing is, but not usually directed at women, and not in a way where I'm discussing the actual anatomical region, I'm not discussing things in a prurient manner. I was merging two words there. In a prurient manner or in a sort of a sexual connotation, I'll just use it usually regarding somebody who's just being, is just being obnoxious or being snippy or snarky.
On Wednesday, I started Hamfisted Radio with a little bit of a clip. There was a YouTube video somebody did that was like 9 minutes long, and I cut about a minute and a half out of it of the 100 greatest insults in movies. And I used it, and one of them was a little clip from Trainspotting. Was somebody calling someone the C word?
Yeah.
And the thing is,
it's a great word.
The British use of it is
like
really kind of awesome.
Yeah.
And it's really almost adorable. It just has just a really great sound to it. But then, like, you know, in an American accent and the context in which Americans tend to use it, it's just relentlessly, horribly crude.
Yeah.
But in the British sense, it's actually a very cool swear word.
Well, here's the thing, and I try to use it in the British way with the C word. Wasn't it an Arrested Development where there was a boat called the C word?
Yes.
It's awesome. That's one of the great little bits of television subversion. Here's the thing. This is like you were talking about how some of the greatest art was made under the Nazi regime when they were so restricted in what they could do and what they couldn't do. And how, Hitler had all of these rules about what you could do with art and what you could paint. Because Hitler, for example, he regarded abstract art as being an abomination. He considered it morally bankrupt. And so there were just all of these strictures put on exactly what you could and could not create if you were an artist. But some of the most interesting art came out of that period because it was people working within these well-defined boundaries. That really is why those boundaries are so great sometimes, because then you get like a Mitchell Hurwitz who finds a way to say anal rapist on television by calling it half analyst, half therapist. He's an anal rapist. And I remember seeing that and just realizing that really is, if you don't have any push, you don't get any pushback. And it's the pushback where all the genius comes. So, in any event. But I try to use the C word always in the British sense because they just... The primary use of the C word, at least from what I've seen with British folk, is that they use it the way we use jackass or a-hole.
Yeah.
But the guy's just being a C. Or sometimes they'll just say it like, they'll say like, well, come on, you silly C. Let's go get a pint at the pub down the way. My preferred mechanism for using the C word is just what I'll do is I'll stick a Y at the end of it, and I will use it synonymously, sort of interchangeably with snarky.
Ah.
You know, snarky or pissy or bitchy. But if I really want to, but the thing is, then I'll forget that I say it all that often, and I will say it in front of somebody, usually a woman, and then I just get what we used to call the hairy eyeball. So I get the stink eye. How do we get off onto this? Oh, because of the printer and the goddamn mother effing. Because it wouldn't.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to get onto a thing. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It is Friday, December 31st, 2010, and welcome to day 12. Thank you for drawing near that ye might be entertained and amused by our various observations and intellectual stylings today. It is New Year's Eve, so we'll wrap up 2010 today. We got a job watch coming up. We got a snuff watch coming up. We got top five coming up later on in the program. Mr. Big Jim Willig, who is in the break room as we speak right now. He is preparing his Humor Me Comedy 101, his year-end edition. He's going to be talking about the life, work, legacy, career, and influence of Mr. George Carlin. We also have another installment of The Greatest Songs Ever Made that's coming up later on this hour. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on your New Year's Eve 2010.
Concert ticket sales dropped dramatically in 2010. A woman is strangled by a neck massager. And a man blames Ozzy Osbourne for his traffic arrest.
Now, when you say strangled by a neck massager, you know, like an automatic neck massager or like a guy named Hans?
No, by like one of those electrical neck massagers, which apparently some people actually use them on their necks.
You're not talking about the thing that's like a U-shaped piece of like the sort of thing. It's like a piece of upholstery or like a pillow that wraps around your neck.
Well, there are a number of.
This isn't the magic wand kind of neck massager.
It doesn't really go into detail about what specific device she was using. I know that there's those things that wrap around. There's the ones that are phallically shaped. There's the kind that looks sort of like a hand mixer that have attachments on the end. So that plug into the wall. So
here's a creepy thing that happens every now and again at Lloyd Center. Apart from like the normal creepiness there, if you walk by the Brookstone store, which I now do more often than I used to because the sharper image is gone, and so I have nowhere to. I can go to Think Geek and I can go to the Sky Mall, but there's no physical outlet for those. So it's like not a place you can really browse in the same way that you could at sharper image. So I'll go to the Brookstone, and I got to tell you, half the things at the Brookstone plug into your iPod, the other half are just meant to jiggle and massage you. They've got like three different kinds of chairs that massage you. They got a massaging pillow. They got a massaging bed. They got a whole bunch of the handheld massagers. And then they have this thing. Look, I don't know where everybody was raised and in what kind of environment people were brought up. But in no kind of social context is it acceptable for you to take off your shoes and your socks and put your bare ass feet on the little scale looking thing that is a foot massager. And it's like every time I go by Brookstone, first of all, what kind of, who raised you? I mean, it's not even being raised by wolves. It's like, it's like being raised by some sort of horrible, sweaty, single-celled organism.
I mean, maybe slips your shoes off if your socks are very clean.
If you're pristine.
And don't have any holes in them.
If you are pristine in the sock area. But the thing is, nobody is, unless you just bought the socks at Woolworths and put them on your feet, they're not going to be clean. So you go by, and it's always like some spongy 20-something guy who's wearing a shirt that has, like the Tasmanian devil on it or something, or it says like Olympic beer drinking champion, gold medal. And he's sitting there with his socks and shoes off, often wearing like sort of sweatpants, and he's got a thumb hooked inside.
Oh,
and then
God.
He's just got his feet sitting there, and he's always leaning back with a look of orgasmic bliss on his face, just going, oh, that's the stuff.
See, there's the difference between Brookstone and Sharper Image. There was a higher class of customers at Sharper Image.
Yeah, if only they could have kept them in business. Instead, we've got, because there's always more idiots than there are smart people. Anyway, so then there's that guy, and he's just sitting there, and he's having his feet wobbled by this thing. But then my question is, who are the people that are always sort of lingering around, like, in line to use the thing next?
No, yeah,
like, what
I know.
Is up with that?
You go, oh, yeah, some guy's using the... Yeah, now that I know that people... Well, I would never have done that anyway, because I would not take my shoes off to use some publicly traded shoe thing.
No, it's not a
the
thing.
The chairs are one thing, but even then I feel a little bit weird because I know that chair's been massaging a lot of strange asses.
Yeah, so I'm just saying, it's like, just think about that the next time you walk by that place.
I did, about a month ago, I did alternately amuse and embarrass my husband at Walgreens when I went to pick up a prescription, and they have chairs, for old people and lazy people and just people like me who just go, nah, screw it, I'm sitting down. By the prescription department, and they had put this, there's a pad you can buy, and it's basically like the chair massager thing, except that it's just sort of a big pad
that
you drape over the back of a chair.
No, that you add onto the chair.
Yeah. And it's like $80-$100. They're really expensive. But they had one that you could play with, on demo at the Walgreens. And so I sat down and we were waiting for them to fill my prescription. I'm sitting in this chair and Patrick's just sort of standing around and I'm sitting there going, ooh, oh, ooh, oh, oh God. Oh, that's not right. Oh, I like that. That's good.
Was it pleasant?
It was very pleasant, but it was very weird how it was like that chair where you feel like somebody has like pointy fingers and they're like sort of moving it up and down your spine and stuff while you're sitting there in a chair. And it doesn't seem like it should be able to do that.
Would Madame like me to knead her buttocks?
Yeah. And it was really, and I was like, I want one of these. And then I looked at it, I was like, oh, it's like $100.
Now, was the thing, was it actually kneading your, or was it just sort of a poking, like a shiatsu kind of a thing?
It's kind of a cross between a poke and a knead. Because you know what it is? It's just some kind of a roller that has nubs that's moving up and down. But it kind of feels like they're like somebody's fingers a little bit. It's really kind of
odd. It's like they're using like a rolling paintbrush that is studded for your pleasure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I can see that.
And then I guess there's probably also a heat attachment thing to a heat device so you can have it warm, I guess. It would be really, really nice. I mean, it was especially nice up like on the upper back shoulder area. But yeah, just, nah.
a few years back when I bought my car, you know, I have the ass warmers and I have the sunroof, which are the two things that I just I viewed as indispensable. I guess that's, to be fair, the sunroof I viewed as indispensable. The heat, the seat warmers I'd never tried, but now having had them, I can never go back.
Yeah.
They offered, though, a different, if I'd gotten a slightly more expensive car.
I miss my ass warmers.
They had the driver's side the heating and massage and.
In the car?
In the car, which seems dangerous, yeah. By the way. Because that seems like the thing where at the end of a long work day, you're going to be in the 26 and just, you know, because the thing is just sort of like, you know, it's just like squeezing your insides of your thighs. You're going, oh, yeah. That's so great. If I just get a little, you know, and just waiting for the, and they're just going to find, they're going to be just be hosing you out of an embankment somewhere. The other thing is, so that was the middle ground. That was, because I got the nicest cheap car you could possibly afford. I was going to say cheapest nice car, but it's not even that. I got the nicest cheap car that I could, you know, that I felt was, that I could justify to myself at that point. And then if you moved up slightly higher, you got the thing where it would, like, massage you. And then I swear to God, if you got the top-of-the-line car that they were trying to pitch me, which, by the way, if you ever wonder why this country went into just, like, a huge financial collapse a couple years, it's because they were trying to sell, like, guys like me, for example, cars that I could clearly not afford. And one of the sort of accessories that car had was it would not only massage you, it would not only heat you, but the seat, the driver's side seat, and I'm presuming the other ones as well, actually had, I don't even know how it worked, if it was like a sort of fan system or something, but the seat would actually cool you during the summer. Oh. It actually had like thousands of little pinpoint holes in the seat. And if you were sweaty, and so basically the thing was, it would get rid of swamp ass. That was the whole, because swamp ass, here's the thing.
The anti-swamp ass feature.
Swamp ass is a scourge.
It is.
And the thing is, there's not just swamp ass, there's back sweat, and the back sweat is no picnic. And then also this, there's the sweat under your arm that you get from, it's like, you know, it maybe like one of your hands, if it's out the window, is dry, but then the other one, it's like right inside the sleeve of your T-shirt or something.
Yeah.
And then the back sweat. Sweat and the arm sweat all dribble together, creating the swamp ass, and it becomes a whole thing. And the thing is, they never used that term. I forget what they called it. They called it
posterior perspiration.
It was something like unwanted perspiration or uncomfortable perspiration near the seat area. And they said, well, this will get rid of that for you. And it was a thing that would actually just blow slightly chilled air, like up the back of your shirt and onto the backs of your thighs while you were driving. And the thing about the massaging seat, that didn't tempt me. But I sat for a good long time trying to figure out whether or not I could justify getting a seat that cooled my ass while I drove.
Yeah, the year and a half I was driving the Free Highlander, which was the most glorious year and a half of driving of my life, where I had the leather seats and the butt warmer and that sort of thing. And at some point I was like looking at it, I went online and I was going, so if you actually had the money that you could afford a $30,000 car and I was going to buy one of these things, what are my options? And one of the things I found, like on the newer Highlanders, you know, you got the Wi-Fi. Yeah, you could like watch movies and the little pull-down screen, the GPS, all that sort of thing. Now, the thing that I really liked was a little thing that you could have that installs, that's underneath the dash, that's like a combination warmer / cooler. That it's like a little mini fridge that you could keep your beverages cold in the car. But also, if you wanted to, you could use it to keep things warm. So, like, you could also set it to warm and put, I guess, I don't know, your lunch in there for later. And it's like, hey, my lasagna is still hot. I have no idea why you would want the warmy part, but the idea of having just, like, cold sodas in my car just, like, delighted me.
Dennis Pitzenbarger at one point when he was writing for, I guess it was when he was at the Portland Mercury. Because that's where it was. He went to the Mercury after the Willamette.
Yeah, he was at the Mercury at the same time I was.
When he was at the Mercury, he actually, and the thing was, he would get a different car every week to test drive. And I learned pretty quickly not to accompany him in any of those test drives because they were just terrifying. But there was this one car that he wanted me to see, and it was a $200,000 Mercedes. And I was like, I got to get in this car because I got to see what a $200,000 car is like. And the answer, by the way, is like so wonderful that I actually had to get out before it just made me, before it just drove me to do the like irremovable feelings of shame about my own existence.
Yeah, I have a friend who was he worked for the Small Business Association, interacting with businesses and doing loans. And so because of his job, he always drove really nice cars, like Mercedes and BMWs. And once you actually are in like a really expensive car, it's sort of, you realize why rich people are as spoiled as they are.
Getting back into your Ford Festiva to go home and just crying to yourself.
Yeah.
Stopping to buy some microwave popcorn. But I got into this $200,000 Mercedes, and one of the things he noted in the back is that the back, and this doesn't even, I mean, this is one of those things that, that exists that doesn't even really seem, it doesn't really even have any legal function unless you were going to find some similarly shaped item to put in there. But it was like a, it was a wine cooler, by which I mean a wine cooler, but it was like the thing you're talking about, the fridge, but it was specifically made to hold wine bottles. And so the thing is, you would put it, it was like those things that, like from Sharper Image, those wine buckets where you put the champagne in and like within like 7 minutes, yeah, it chills the champagne to whatever temperature. It was like that, but it folded out of the back seat. So you would, he goes, look in the back seat. And I look in the back seat and he presses a button somewhere and he goes, and this little panel opens between sort of the passenger and driver's sides of the back seat. Like right in the middle, this sort of door comes down and like sort of hidden in the back, like a little alcove, like a place where you would hide your guns, let's say, is just this little chilling compartment. And it held one bottle of wine and two long-stemmed wine glasses. And then he goes, yeah, you can put a bottle of white wine in there, and it'll be down to, 64 degrees Fahrenheit within 9 minutes. And then he just closed it back up again, and then we got out, and I went inside and just,
Well, I guess if you're spending that kind of money for a car, you probably have a driver.
Probably.
So you're sitting in the back, and you're enjoying your wine.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I would, it's like, at what point do they run out of, things, and they just have to start, like, flipping around, like, through catalogs and just looking for other crap they can stick into the car. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It is Friday, December 31st, 2010. Big Jim Willie coming up later on today. Snuff Watch, Job Watch, greatest songs ever made, and so forth. And by the way, if at any point it sounds like I'm just like I got a hitch or McGiddy up, like I'm just pausing for a fraction of a second too long between words, I got this thing going on today, and I don't really know what's going on with me, and I'm just choosing to. I've learned that the best way to deal with anything medical in my life is to ignore it. Mm. So I'm just going to pretend this isn't happening, and then it's either going to turn out to be nothing, or it will kill me. In which case, I don't have to worry about it any longer.
Or maybe you'll end up turning yellow and have to have your gallbladder taken out.
There's that too. I've got a fine selection of coat hangers at home, though, so I feel like I'm going to be able to do any sort of med surge activities myself in the privacy of my own residence. I got this thing happening today where every now and again, and it's really no more than two or three times a minute. I just have this weird sensation, like right in the middle of my chest, right here, as though someone is standing on me. So I'm not really sure. I'm sure it's just what do they always say? I'm sure it's gas.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not a heart attack or anything.
Now, see, it's probably
terrible.
Not a heart attack, though. That's the thing. And it does feel like I'm being put in some incredibly tight or firm bear hug. But, but then it goes away again. And then it comes back. But then it goes away before it comes back. Here's the thing, though. Here's why I'm sure it's not a heart attack. And it started happening the minute I got out of bed this morning.
Mm.
And it seems like if I stand up really quickly, it gets worse. But it's not a heart attack. And here's how I know that. Because years ago, when I went to the hospital for a panic attack, which this is not, by the way, because I know what a panic attack feels like. But the reason I know is because I went to the doctor because I thought I was having a heart attack and whatever. And he actually said something that I don't know if he was trying to make me feel better or if he was feeling especially like jocund that day. But he said, oh, no, if it were a heart attack, you would have been dead an hour ago. And I said, really? And he goes, he's like, if you have any of the symptoms of a heart attack, like the pain in your, chest or your jaw, or your left arm goes numb or whatever, it's like, if you don't get that taken care of, he's like, the odds are, unless it's just the most mild heart attack imaginable, like, you will be dead within 10 or 12 minutes. He's like, you won't be able to make, you're not going to drive to the hospital with that. Like, you will already be gone. Which actually made me feel like that actually has been a massively useful piece of advice, because in the subsequent years when I would get a panic attack, then I would just think to myself, all right, well, if I'm still here in 5 minutes, not a heart attack. And then I would just sort of wait it out. So it's a long 5 minutes, but then it would just vanish instantly.
Hmm.
So this is not that. I don't know what this is.
Now, is it actually in, like, where your sternum is, or
right,
a little lower than
it
that?
It's right here.
Oh, okay.
Right. It is right there, right dead center, like about a half inch below my nipples, but right in the middle of my chest.
So this is, if it was a little lower around the solar plexus, then that could be like acid reflux or something. But
yeah,
dead in the middle of your chest. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's not. And I don't believe. And
you could have also just pulled a muscle or something.
I have no idea. Yeah, if I stand up, I actually had to walk up the stairs. And when I walked up the stairs, suddenly it got really bad. But then again, it went away. So every now and again, though, it's like a series of horses, one sedan, and a small midget are balanced on my chest. So,
well, that, That doesn't sound good. I'm not a healthcare professional, but that doesn't sound good.
I just wanted
good.
To make you aware in case in case I grimaced, okay. Like just now, for example, it's not something you're saying,
right.
You know, and you're not off-putting to me visually in any way. It's just it's a thing.
Well, fortunately, Big Jim Willig is here today, so if
I should keel over, he can provide laughter in my stead.
Right, or at least he's a big, sturdy, hearty guy. He can, like, hoist you over his shoulder and we can, like, haul you to the emergency room or something.
And then he can be hitting me in the chest and go, don't let the bastard win!
Live, damn you! Live!
Jim Willig will be in the studio later on today to do George Carlin as his year-end subject for Humor Me Comedy 101 and Greatest Songs Ever Made coming up here in just a few. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Family and friends are searching for answers after their loved one died following plastic surgery. According to 35-year-old Lidvian Zelaya's husband, Osvaldo Vargas, his wife died after she went to a plastic surgery center in Broward County, Florida, on Monday.
I'm sorry, where?
Florida.
My fault.
Zelaya's family's attorney, Spencer Ehrenfeld, held a press conference with the victim's family Thursday afternoon. People are not supposed to die undergoing plastic surgery, he said, and they're certainly not supposed to die undergoing an elective cosmetic procedure as simple as this one.
Did they say, I missed this, what form of plastic surgery was it?
I'm really not sure. I haven't found that out yet.
Because that's the thing where, like,
in for liposuction.
Well, do they have to put you under for liposuction? Or maybe they don't. I don't really know the answer to that.
She went for liposuction and another surgery procedure that was not named.
Well, that's what killed Kanye's mother. Kanye West's mom died from complications during plastic surgery. And it wasn't like she had some pre-existing condition that was triggered. It was like, it was just one of those things where, like, whenever you have a medical procedure, there is some risk involved.
Oh, yeah.
So,
The attorney believes something went wrong at the center because Zelaya had to be transported to Florida Medical Center in Lauderdale Lakes. Shortly after arriving at the emergency room, she was pronounced dead. Her New Year's resolution was to simply look better, said Ehrenfeld. We don't know yet whether that was caused by human error or a complication or by malpractice. We don't know that.
We do know that she's going to be thinner, though.
Her husband, Osvaldo Vargas, said in Spanish, she died looking for beauty, but to me, she was already beautiful. She was always happy. She was always smiling. She was always dancing. She was beautiful.
Except for right there at the end with the dancing.
Except apparently she was not happy with herself because she was getting plastic surgery.
Well, I was going to say, Osvaldo Vargas says that now.
Yeah.
But I wonder what he said 2 weeks ago. Here's the thing about the liposuction. Do you ever sit and watch the liposuction surgeries they'll have in the Discovery Channel occasionally?
Yeah.
There is, like, they should just have like a med-surg channel where you could just sit and just watch people having stuff done. I would watch that all the time because I don't find it. Like, I know a lot of people are put off by that or squeamish or about blood or whatever, and I'm really not for whatever reason. So it's not like I go out of my way to see it or anything, but it's like I don't get weirded out by watching surgery. Was it you that's weirded out by seeing people that it's not by blood as such, but by seeing things cut?
No, that's my husband.
Okay,
that's Patrick.
Yeah.
Scalpels and razors just completely freak him out.
Saying that, like, he could see the, like, on Dexter, like, he didn't mind seeing, like, the after effect of, like, the big puddle of blood, but just, like, seeing the cutting wasn't with.
He doesn't like watching surgery, even fake surgery on shows like House and stuff, and he can't watch the cutting at all.
Really?
Yeah.
It'll go by occasionally, and one of the only things I've ever seen on the Discovery Channel, and it was Discovery Health apparently was the name of that channel, that kind of weirded me out. It wasn't so much like a surgery or like cutting or like, you know, pulling a guy open. It was when they were doing the liposuction. And the liposuction, it's like when the Orkin guy comes to your house to exterminate, and he's just got that Okay, how weird that I just talked about the Orkin guy exterminating and your phone started making cricket noises.
That was the
hell was that about?
That was the alert to make sure that we went and got Jim if he was outside.
Yeah, because it's like 4 degrees outside, and we thought the building was closed today. And here's a little fun fact. The last 2 weeks in a row, I've just left Jim standing, and it's me. It's not Dawn, it's me. I have left Jim standing outside for like 20 minutes. And then I'll check my – and then I'll finally remember it because Donald will go, like, didn't we have to do something? Jim! And I'll run downstairs. And he'll be out there just – and he's such a nice, mellow guy. And he never complains about it. But then I look at my phone later and there's a series of text messages like, let me in. Please let me in. Why won't you let me in? For the love of God, I can see you from the sidewalk.
It's so cold out here.
I can no longer feel my hands. I'm typing with my nose. What was I saying? Oh, but watching the liposuction thing. So there's a guy, he looks like an exterminator. He looks like John Goodman in Arachnophobia, where he's got this long, long metal tube. But with lipo, they just take the long metal tube and they just jam it up into you. And then it's like they're raking a carpet. It's like they're just going, and they're back and forth like they're just like
and
they're
the
getting
horrible, nasty, yellow fat stuff
but
comes out. And
but they're running the thing back
horrible.
And forth like they're just doing a once over on a shag before mom and dad come home, you know? It's just, it's so horrible to watch. Yeah. But it was strangely fascinating. And they are, I guess, just vacuuming out the fat, you know, which is, you know, I mean, hey, that's what we've got science for. So, I mean, who's to rule? I mean, I would not rule out the possibility that, you know, I mean, it's, you know, who is to say what cosmetic procedures might lurk in my future? So I'm glad that those things are there should I ever need them.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I will say this. Somebody that I know but will not identify. I was downtown, I don't know, maybe 6-8 weeks ago. And someone who is known. I will be this guy just once. Someone who is known to the show.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who is known to the show was downtown and had just gotten a chemical peel done. That thing where they just they smooth up your face.
Oh yeah.
And it wasn't like a dermabrasion thing. It's I mean, it is similar to that, but it's where they do it with, I guess they just burn off a few layers of your skin.
Pretty much, yeah.
They just douse you with hydrochloric acid or something, and then what's left is you know just as you know just as tightened and you know and wrinkle free as that of a newborn child. And this person did have a really healthy glow on their face. And the thing is, when you first get done with that procedure, and I think they had just left the office for like, you know, like just a couple of minutes, and they had the weird, you know, there's a weird redness. It's like you've gotten a sunburn and then it peeled immediately, but then someone slapped you for a long time and then covered you with baby oil. It's like a weird, weird sort of thing. But they couldn't wait to tell me all about it. And then I swear to God, took the doctor's card out of their pocket and handed it to me and said that if I made an appointment that day, I would get 10% off. And I really was tempted to do it, just, you know, for the savings or for the amusement of it. But so I have no problem with that sort of thing. But the liposuction is just, it's disturbing to watch.
Yeah.
Because you just get the feeling that if that guy just sneezes or trips or falls or something, and it's like the hose goes up, you know, a few inches too far, he's going to be vacuuming out something like your lungs. And you probably don't want those vacuumed.
Mm-mm.
I mean, so it would seem to me.
No.
Here is Don Taylor.
Did you ever send me the sound for the concert?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Then I'll read that in a minute. As downloading makes it harder for musicians to make a living, the music industry has turned to concerts to help it stay in the black.
All right, let's go back and clarify that. Let's fix that to make it correct, as the internet kids say. As illegal downloading,
yes,
can sometimes make it more difficult for musicians to earn a living.
Yeah, and you know, and you may not agree with that statement that downloading makes it harder for musicians to make
a living. No, no, no. I added qualifiers there that can sometimes
illegal downloading can sometimes. Impact musicians' income. The music industry has turned to concerts to try and continue to rake in massive amounts of money. Unfortunately, it's not working out so well either. According to the trade magazine Pollstar, international concert ticket sales fell 12% this year, dropping from $3.35 billion in 2009 to $2.93 billion this past year. In a perhaps more ominous sign of decline, Bon Jovi's 53-city tour was the biggest in the world this year, grossing $201.1 million. Even though concert profits have been rising prior to 2010, the gains were artificial. Individual prices just rose while the actual number of ticket sales stayed the same.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It has nothing to do with...
Same with movie tickets.
Yeah, I mean, it was like when they talk about how, you know, the highest grossing movie of this year, you know, is not the same as, you know, I mean, I guess Avatar being the exception. Whatever's number one at the box office is still not making the same amount that movie would have made 5 or 10 or 15 years ago. But that has nothing to do with the movie. That has nothing to do with anything. That is a result of two things. One, that we have more entertainment options.
Yeah.
And ancillary to the fact that we have more entertainment options, because we have more entertainment options and because of things like downloading. And by the way, I read something yesterday. There was a what they claim is the first – it was like the Pew Research Group or something. What they claim is the first or at least the most definitive survey about music buying habits in a digital world where, you know, you're taking into account illegal downloading and file sharing and torrents and iTunes and Rhapsody and Napster. And they said that now – 65% of people who identify themselves as music consumers do pay for the bulk of their music online. Now, that could just be 51% of their music. It doesn't mean that's all of it. It just means a majority of it, which I believe, because the last within the last 5 or 6 weeks, I've actually been at several people's homes or talked to several people who have things like the Rhapsody service. And I, you know, probably 2-3 years ago, I was the only person I knew that used, because I used the Napster service, and I have just for years, because it's the best. It's unbelievably great. It's one of the best things that I have ever used. But I was the only person I knew with a subscription service. And now, I mean, I probably know 6 or 7 people that are using some variant on that. But the thing is that as more music becomes easily available, what is more difficult is for the record industry to get the entire country to pay attention to one band and to say, everybody must now buy this album this year. And so when you can't get the entire country to agree on buying or listening to an album, you can't get them to agree to all go to the concert.
Right.
So you can't get anybody's attention long enough to all get them interested in the same thing. That's the reason why concert ticket sales, you know, are not increasing.
And we talked about yesterday that U2, their concert, they ended up canceling all their North American
right.
tour dates. And so they still ended up coming in third as far as, you know, concert ticket sales are concerned. And then number two was AC/DC. Whereas this fellow from Polestar said that critics haven't been particularly kind to AC/DC lately, but enough fans paid to see them that it actually put them in second place.
AC/DC last year had the second biggest tour, 226 million. You know, this year was a little less, but they worked fewer dates. It was all earlier in the year. On a global basis, for the 2 years that they were out touring, they did incredibly huge business.
Well, they're the very definition of a band that is just critic proof, though, because it doesn't. I mean.
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't make any difference at all what they release, you know, what their records do, or whether the critics like it or whether they don't. I mean, because you know what AC/DC is? Here's the thing: AC/DC is they are the musical equivalent of that phenomenon we were discussing yesterday about stars who have one failed movie after another, and yet they continue to be popular. They continue to be A-listers, right?
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. Digital Music News is saying that the top 50 grossing touring acts in 2009 had an average audience age of 46.
Right.
You know, it's not kids who are like, you know, scraping together their allowance to go see their favorite band in concert. It's adults who are going to see bands that they've been following for years and years and years.
There's that, but I would also say that AC/DC is distinct from the rest of those bands in this way. If you take Bon Jovi might be a little bit of an exception too, because they have managed to translate to some degree. Have managed to translate their success to subsequent generations. Not entirely, but much more so than many of their contemporaries. And you don't see, like, there are no kids out there listening to Trickster. So they're maybe the wrong example to use here. But I would say that you go see a lot of bands, and let's be honest, you know, you go to see Metallica, and everybody there is 50 years old. You go to see The Cure. We talked about them yesterday being a legacy act, and everybody there is, you know, 40 years old and up. AC/DC is different, though. You see AC/DC, and it doesn't matter what year you see them, it doesn't matter what decade, or whether they've had a hit single, or whether they're whatever. That is a thing where you will see like 65-year-old people, and you will see 16-year-old kids, because they are absolutely timeless. They are like the Ramones in that way. That every single year, there is a new generation of embittered, greasy youths who discover Highway to Hell or Back in Black, and they go, this is the best thing I've ever heard! I didn't know things could be this awesome. And then they go to see Angus Young, you know, wobble around like a schoolboy, and, you know, and that huge cannon thing go off at the end when they play For Those About to Rock that feels like it's going to cave in your chest. That's what I mean when I say AC/DC is critic-proof. It's like they are, you know, they're like the In-N-Out Burger of rock, where they just do this one thing and they do it really well, better than anybody else in the history of the form. And they just, I mean, they could just, you know, just going to play until they, although they, and they were saying this jazz last year that it was going to be their farewell tour, that this was going to be the last time they toured. And then that sort of vanished about halfway through. So I wonder if they made enough money or didn't make enough money, but it sounds like they did, that they made enough money that, you know, they, you know, the account was like one more, you know, and so now they're going to be, this is especially impressive, by the way, because I would imagine if you took the average AC/DC fan and asked them to name the band's last 5 albums, they probably couldn't. If they were asked to name the album the band was touring on for this, they probably couldn't name it.
Yeah.
And that's largely because the last album, which was Black Ice, was only available at Walmart. Couldn't buy it online, couldn't get it at iTunes. You could only get it at Walmart and then later at their own website, which is where they run their online store from. So Anyway, I could go on about AC/DC all day. Have you ever seen them?
I have never seen them.
You're missing out on one of life's real. The thing is, that's like a bingo square you can't leave uncovered. Mm. You have to see AC/DC if you're a human being. Seriously, if you walk on planet Earth, you have to. It's part of the human cultural imperative.
I will put that on the list.
You're not going to put it on the list. Don't lie to me.
Put it on the list.
Turn this into a house of deception. Damn you.
Put a lot of things on the list.
Okay. Do we have more from that guy?
You tell me. I didn't ever get the email you sent me, supposedly. So.
Let's see. He also says, you know, Don, it's no surprise that, we'll see if this actually plays. He says, no surprise that Lady Gaga was number four on this this list of
when an act like Lady Gaga has the kind of year that she did, then it's not surprising that she would finish in the top five either.
And lastly, he says Bon Jovi keeps running strong.
Bon Jovi continues to amaze me with their strength, not just in North America but globally. The band has, you know, was passed over for a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nomination, but certainly the public is still enraptured with the band.
See, and that's, you know, we'll wrap this up here in a second. We'll do take a break. We'll come back. Jim Willig's going to be here. We got your Snuffwatch, Jobwatch, greatest songs ever. It's interesting that he mentions Bon Jovi here because they were the highest grossing act of the year tour wise, and I'm not a fanatic, but I'm a fairly large Bon Jovi fan, and I don't think I could tell you what their new album was. I mean, they almost certainly had one because they're sort of great though. And I just say this to hear people's heads explode. Bon Jovi is sort of like the Rolling Stones in that they could just tour on like Living, you know, they could just play One of Dead or Alive and Living on a Prayer like forever. But they continue to put out a new record about every 18 months, which is sort of great. But one of the reasons, and I have felt this, I've said this like from the very beginning, I've said this since grunge came along and just sort of killed off an entire, like a heavy frost, killed off an entire generation of bands. The reason why Jon Bon Jovi and his band continue to be A-listers is because you cannot picture them being anything but A-listers. In other words, you can't picture them playing at a tavern on the corner, you know, the way that you could like the guys in Cinderella.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you just picture some, you know, Poison is the same way. When you picture Poison, you know, who are not as big as Bon Jovi, but who are still a big band and who still tour every year until, you know, I mean, they sell at 10,000 seaters. You know, if you picture some other, you know, like Europe or somebody, it's like, you know, well, you know, they're going to be coming to the Roseland if they're lucky. But you picture.
Well, we were talking about Cheap Trick having, you know, going the ups and downs of Cheap Trick. It's like, oh, they're playing the Taste of Beaverton.
Yeah.
And then a couple of years later, oh, they're in a Coliseum again.
Because they can sort of float between every, you know, you can see them playing in every kind of venue. When you picture Bon Jovi.
Yeah, don't imagine Bon Jovi coming and playing the Clark County Amphitheater for the state fair.
I mean, it's just not a thing. Your mind cannot conjure them just playing at Barbati's or something. And so then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because they just seem like huge stars because they so successfully position themselves as that and they've got that certain the gravitas. Therefore, they just stay big stars. I mean, I really do think that is part of it. I think there's just people who just seem like they are bigger than life. And so that perception does like 80% of the job for them and allows them to remain at that level, even when times change around them. So there is some sort of psychological phenomenon happening there. And I don't quite know what it is, but there's something going on.
It's the hair.
Probably.
They have awesome hair.
Well, and he's got those, you know, and the thing is, and he's you know, he's got those teeth.
He's still adorable. And he's, what, 50 now?
Yeah.
He's still adorable.
Have you seen Bon Jovi?
The band?
Yes.
No, I've never seen them.
Really? What is it? Did you even leave the house?
You know, when I was, I have to admit, back in the day when Bon Jovi were sort of at their height, I hated them.
Yeah.
I loathed them.
You secretly liked them later, though.
And I have a friend who just like loved Bon Jovi, and it didn't help that she's completely tone deaf, and she would sing along with their songs on the radio and couldn't sing it all. And it just made me hate them even more.
See, you hated them the way I did, though. You hated them outright, and then you hated them outwardly, but inwardly began to like some of their songs. And then later, you sort of will go, well, I mean, I like them. I mean, you know, it's bad, but I mean, it's sort of fun, you know, if you're drunk or if you're out or something. And then later, you hit a certain age, and you were just like, F you, I like Bon Jovi, and you can eat it if you don't like it.
I don't think I've hit that last part yet, though.
Yeah, but I would say that you would.
F you, I like Bon Jovi part.
But you would not deny that you if there was a Bon Jovi song that came on the radio that you liked, you wouldn't deny it.
There are a few that I'm okay with. I don't hate them. And yes, they are very, a lot of their songs are very bouncy and very catchy.
If you give Love a Bad Name came on the radio, you would not change the station at a stoplight to avoid being seen by others.
I might. I really don't like that song.
I'm just saying. What is the Bon Jovi song of choice in Don Taylor's head? In the jukebox of your mind?
God, I don't know. I don't know. They are literally one of those bands that they come along, and a lot of the songs, like Living on a Prayer, I really don't like. And also Give Love a Bad Name, I don't like those songs. And I admit that they're bouncy and catchy, and that's, but I don't like them. I know there are a couple of Bon Jovi songs I don't loathe, but off the top of my head, I can't think of what they are.
Have you considered the possibility that maybe your pleasure center was removed at birth?
There might be that. It's my tiny, cold, black little heart.
Okay. You know what'll make that heart grow three sizes, Don?
What?
Storm Large's vagina. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. This is where I was going to do greatest songs ever, but we're running behind. So we should take a break. We'll come back with Big Jim Willig and Humor Me Comedy 101 today, the life, legacy, and career of Mr. George Carlin. Still to come, Snuffwatch, Job Watch, and greatest songs ever. I want to play this. So it's funny because I had already got this. I had this racked up to play because somebody had emailed me a couple days ago and they wanted to hear it. And it's funny. We were talking about profanity at the beginning of the show. When Storm's song 8 Miles Wide came out, it was, you know, it was one of those things that we talked about a lot. And I do some singing on it at the end, but that's sort of incidental because you can't really hear me. I'm sort of buried in the I'm deep in the mix, as they
Although,
say.
Although if you've seen the video, we know it's you.
That's true. You know who else sings on this? I don't know if they actually say this, but our fair mayor,
yes,
sings on this song. Although apparently he talking about a guy who just is tone deaf. Apparently he's such a terrible singer that he's like buried so far in there. I don't even know if he made it into the final mix or whatever. I just know that they were trying to figure out a way to like auto-tune him into some sort of usability. In any event, so when this song came out, you know, it was terrestrial radio was still on that post Janet Jackson thing where we were just so terrified of being fined because the fine was $325,000 per station per occurrence. And in this song, the occurrences would have been like in the dozens. So I didn't even want to play an edited version of this. But with just some very minor alterations, though, it occurred to me the other day we can actually play this. So take a break. We'll play this little Storm Large ditty for you. Come back with Mr. Jim Willig on the other side with Humor Me, Comedy 101. This is Storm Large singing My Vagina is 8 Miles Wide on the Rick Emerson radio program. Back after this. Stay right there.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
All of my life, I've never fit, but I won't complain and I won't quit. I am enormous. Get used to it. Everyone tells me I'm too much. Maybe it's just you're not enough for me. Can't you see? I'm the kind of woman I'm supposed to be. Womanly to you, strong but not too much of a brute. It's cool if she's powerful, but way better if she's cute. Well, for all of us girls who don't fit in, I say go Amazonian. You could be a kick-ass bruiser and I'm not a whore. This is a metaphor for my super fantastically mystical feminine goddess core. And I hate it when women make that noise that we don't need daddies, men, or boys. Even the hardcore dykes love China. It's universal, like like a penis, but reversible. Come on in, the water's fine. It's not my vagina, it's our vagina. My vagina is 8 miles wide. Everyone can come in, come in, come inside. Echo, 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 whoa, 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 just the boys.
My vagina is 8 miles wide. Absolutely everyone can come in.
Listening to the Emerson News Network.
Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Joining us just a moment, Mr. Big Jim Willig with Humor Me Comedy 101. We've also got Snuff Watch on the way, Job Watch on the way, and more. It is New Year's Eve, so I was going to lead into something that I have no idea what I was going to lead into. So I'm just going to be sitting at home tonight eating a large quantity of spreadable cheese. That's sort of my big plan. Don Taylor, you?
I got nothing. I'm doing nothing.
Really? Even after during Legion of News, you're saying, and no one invited me to anything, and then sort of looking at your phone?
Yeah,
no,
that didn't lead to any invitations
really?
Of any kind.
I thought it would just ring off the hook suddenly. Just, well, by God, I'll step in and be the social savior.
You'd think. People just going, oh, Don's not doing anything. Let's invite her to our thing. No, not a word. Nothing, not a peep.
Okay.
No, I'm just going to be sitting around with my husband, staring at each other, going, Happy New Year! Happy New Year to you! Probably do what we usually do, which is just go to bed early and then wake up sometime in the middle of the night and go, oh yeah, we missed it. And then go back to sleep.
Yeah. Here's the comforting thing about this is that if you're on the Xbox Live, at some point during the evening you will see Seamus log on, and then the same thing will happen. Well, you'll get an email from him at 12:15 or 12:30, because this has happened several years in a row, I think, where he'll just say Happy New Year, back to Call of Duty, bye, and that's it. It's he basically just lives in some snow fortress, just some cavern of solitude, deep in the heart of the Rockies or whatever, and doesn't really ever leave the house or go anywhere. And I think it was his Christmas just involved playing Black Ops, of course. And I think he said that in advance of Christmas and the knowledge that he would not be leaving the house, he not only did he go to Walgreens to preemptively get... Did I ever read that email on the air?
No.
About him playing Black Ops? It might have been something I read on the air, but you might have been gone that day. It might have been with Snyder, but I'll read it again. But he actually, in anticipation of the Christmas holiday, went to the store and bought 17 of those Totino's pizzas. That cost, and he was like, and that's it. And I think he actually cooked them all at once. And then we'd occasionally just toast them back to warmth whenever he wanted to ingest one. And then it was just that. There's that and thumbing his life away on Xbox, which is sort of awesome. I mean, that's the thing about being an adult, It's like being an adult, I don't have to eat asparagus. I don't have to to spend time with family or people that I don't want to if I don't want to. And if I want to spend the waking moment that I'm not here at work playing video games, there's really no one to stop me except my wife, and she does that very infrequently. So I can live my life as I choose, as he does, as do we all. So,
well, I am on Sunday. I will be getting an enormous free TV. So
that's right.
So I am going to be spending some of the weekend sort of you know, moving things around in anticipation of my giant free TV.
So is this now, is that when it's being delivered? Now, have you figured out how is it getting to your house?
Mr. Mike Russell is going to actually bring the television to me, and then he will help me put it into place because Patrick can't be hoisting things, so...
Is that really true, or is that the story that Patrick is
No, that's really true. Apparently, after you have a surgery of the type he had, you're not supposed to lift anything over 10 pounds for, like, 6 weeks or something, so...
Before we do anything else, let's welcome out of the... Let's welcome out of the Rick Emerson Show, Mr. Big Jim Willick. Hello, sir.
Hello.
How are you?
Happy holidays
happy,
to you,
Happy preemptive New Year to you. Big plans for you. Are you working tonight?
No, I'm off today and tomorrow, mercifully. So I'm going to be thinking globally and drinking locally.
Excellent.
I failed to. I was going to come visit you at your porn palace over
Christmas,
and I completely I lost it entirely. I was like, at some point, like the middle of the night, I was like, oh, I was going to do something. Like, oh, god damn!
Well, the thing is, even in the middle of the night, when you remembered, we were still open, vigilantly, like the postal service through dark of night, or you know.
Let me ask you this: at the adult emporium where you are employed, is there ever a time of day when there aren't people there? In other words, like you know, you got to figure maybe during the late night hours it slows down, but then again, maybe not.
There's usually at least one customer, if not in the arcades, in the store at all times.
There's a little booths in the back.
Kind of like the guard at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. There has to be at least one person present at all times.
So there's it's not like when Last Call happens. There's a lot of people who either have found, you know, they found that special someone and, you know, they want to stop off and get the appropriate aids and accoutrements on the way home, or they have not found that special someone and they're going to stop off and get the Area 69 sex doll.
Yes, actually, you can set your watch when working graveyard by 2:30 because you get like a sudden massive rush of drunk people that just come wandering in needing any menagerie of things.
Before we go to the news desk here, and then we'll get to the Humor Me Comedy 101 coming up later on with George Carlin. We got Snuff Watch, Job Watch, all that. I want to read this from Seamus. So he sent this to me. So this is actually some time ago. He sent this. This is in early December. Just a couple weeks after Black Ops had come out. So Black Ops is the newest Call of Duty game. It was Modern Warfare and then Modern Warfare 2, and then I guess Black Ops is the follow up to that. He says, I've put in just under 240 hours on Black Ops since
Good
it came
Lord.
Out. Since it came out just under a month ago. That's more than 8 hours per day. I dream about Black Ops. I think about it. I strategize in my head when I'm not playing it. The moment I wake up, I start playing it. I only pause to eat and work. And since I work from home, sometimes I don't even pause for that. Don't tell anyone. I have played so much that my eyes feel like they've been rubbed down with sandpaper. I just now finally stopped myself so I could find something else to do for a few hours to give my eyes a rest, because they hurt so bad that I can't get any kills in the game. I might have to go pick up some eye drops from Walgreens just so I can keep playing. He says, I have concluded that just as much as we ridicule ourselves for spending so much time with leisure and entertainment, it does serve a purpose. The speed with which mankind is advancing, perhaps in some areas beyond its maturity or our ability to control or fully grasp our own advances, is only tempered by man's affinity for sports, video games, movies, and other entertainment. You could look at these millions of man years lost to frivolity not as lost productivity, but as millions of man years man has not devoted to developing space travel and immortality before we're ready to be spacefaring folk out among the rest of the civilizations in the universe. So, in a sense, he says, I am doing my part to ensure the cautious pacing of advancement of the entire human race, along with everyone else who is playing Black Ops. We who have accumulated 20,000 man years of game time in the past 29 days.
Wow. So,
and incidentally, he notes that if you're playing Black Ops and as you enter the game lobby, there's a marquee like the New York Times headline ticker that notes the stats, the in-game world stats, such as like how many kills in the game, how many explosions in the game, how many cubic feet of earth displaced by explosions during the game. And it, like one month after the game, it was literally something like 7 billion deaths or something. It was like unreal. And it was, you know, like 75,000 hours of, you know, of man years or something, the playtime. I mean, it's insane. And I guess that just updates like forever. So, I mean, it's a great and it's a great and strange time to be us.
No joke. I mean, it harkens back to, was it Next Generation, where there was that game being passed around the Enterprise that was like obviously becoming addictive, and the crew became obsessed by it.
I don't think I remember that.
Really? It was like a virtual reality game with like bouncing shapes and whatnot, and there was like a hypnotic kind
of
thing.
That's not the thing where Moriarty, they trapped Moriarty from the Sherlock Holmes thing in the cube at the end.
Not something else altogether.
Yeah. No, that was a different. They were all playing a game thing.
Okay. Thank God we dedicated our lives to non-video game based knowledge and pursuits.
I was going to say it's good that I'm not like those guys in the Enterprise wasting my life on tedious minutia. All right. At the news desk, it's Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
An Ohio drunk driving suspect is blaming his arrest on Ozzy Osbourne. William Liston was arrested Christmas Eve in suburban Cleveland. He told officers, "Ozzy Osbourne and his music made me do it." Osbourne's hits as lead singer of the heavy metal band Black Sabbath and as a solo artist include Paranoid and Road to Nowhere. Liston is awaiting arraignment. He's to appear in court Tuesday on the charge of operating a vehicle while impaired.
I love the – he's like a retro drunk driver, you know?
Yeah.
Like he's sort of a – you know, it's like an I love the 80s weekend with drunk driving.
In a completely unrelated case, the same guy pleaded not guilty Thursday to a November break-in at a medical office. And he was released on bond.
Okay.
Apparently, that wasn't Ozzy's fault.
That was Dio's fault.
I was going to go Venom, but Dio is better.
Thank you.
Well done. All right. Awesome. It's funny how nobody ever blames anything on, you know, nobody ever blames anything on the music of Jim Nabors ever. It's always Ozzy. And if you go back and you watch Decline of Western Civilization 2, which I do with a fair amount of frequency because I went through this period.
What did you do with Rob Halford? We're standing here right now. I'd probably jump his bones.
If you go back and watch that movie, it's so great because it's like a I loved it when it came out because when I first saw Decline of Western Civilization 2, which is the Penelope Spheeris documentary, which you undoubtedly have seen. And I think it's actually out of print. You can get it bootleg, but I don't think it's actually out on DVD. I think the rights fell into some weird form of like the rights are like an escrow with somebody somewhere. So I don't think anybody owns it right now. But when I first saw it, it was like I was sort of living in that era, so it was like it was great. And then I kind of went through this period when I didn't really watch it because it seemed kind of vaguely depressing, which it still does. But now it's depressing but with this sort of sheen of like it's a perfect time capsule in some ways of a certain era and a certain type of music in a certain part of the world. But there is a great moment on that where they're talking about Ozzy Osbourne and the demonic influence of his music. And if you watch Don't Blame Me, which is the Ozzy Osbourne documentary that came out around that same time, like in maybe 90 or so, there's a guy who is – it's so great because he's giving like this scientific clinical explanation about how backward messages work and about how if you listen to Suicide Solution, it actually says pick up the gun and shoot, which is just great. And, you know, and it's like you forget like what a collective psychosis we all went through as a country. You know, where you're like your parents were like sitting down and telling you like as thinking logical adults that if you listen to the wrong records at the wrong time or in the wrong way in your bedroom, that like a demon would appear and would capture your soul and drag you to Hades, which is just sort of and that was just like a couple years ago, really, in the grand scheme of things. It's just a bizarre thing.
Well, it was the 80s, which was, really influenced by cocaine usage. And, I mean, because they were blaming everything on everything, like the Dungeons and Dragons, the movie Mazes and Monsters. If you watch it today, is hilarious.
Yeah, isn't that the thing where what is that scene in Mazes and Monsters where he's at the phone booth and he's freaking out? Is it Tom Hanks at the phone booth?
Yeah,
it's Tom Hanks. Basically, what had happened was he was addicted to the game, had to leave one college, went to another one, ends up falling in with a bunch of bad kids that are all also playing the game. He gets into it. They find this cave. He freaks out, gets way too into the game, flees, goes into the city, still in game mode, knifes a guy in an alleyway, freaks out, realizes maybe this game isn't that, you know, what it's cracked up to be, and then calls a friend. And then at the end, he's at an institution somewhere.
I don't remember it having that down of an ending.
Oh, it was severe. Like, they all come to visit him.
A cautionary tale.
And he's, like, permanently stuck in game mode.
where he is Valcor, yeah, like for the rest of his life.
Just like, oh, and the Elfling is shown. Yeah, hello, let us have some, you know, the Dinkleberry juice.
And then they walk out into the hallway and they shut the door and they just shake their head sadly. And then it's, at the end, does it do that whole, like, if you or someone you know has a gaming addiction, please call 1-800.
Actually, what happened was a Native American gentleman threw a water fountain through a window and escaped quietly, never to be seen again.
Hey, you know, I was watching, I've been tying everything back to House lately because I've been power loading that show and trying to catch up. They did something on House, I mean, it wasn't recently, but it was recently for me. It was like at the end of maybe season five or something, that I have not seen for years, for probably a decade at least. They did that thing at the end of House where they put up the whole, if you or somebody you know is struggling with issues of depression or suicide, please. It was where what's-his-name kills himself.
Oh, yeah.
And they put up the, you know, please call the 800. It was strange because I haven't, I didn't think they did that anymore. But I guess that's a whole, there's, you skip the generation and now people don't view it as corny. And so now they're able to do it again, which
what's
is
what's popular now is apathy.
Yes.
It's very big nowadays.
Just as one final thing on the Back in the Mazes and Monsters tip, as a sort of sister movie to that, did you ever see Trick or Treat with Mark Price?
Yes, with Ozzy as the...
As the preacher?
Yes.
These evil people have got to be stopped.
I met Mark Price at a party once.
Have you told me this? I don't think you've told me
Didn't
this story.
I never tell you
Why
this?
Would you not have told me that you met Skippy from Family Ties?
It was awesome. I was at a party at a friend's house and we were standing around in like the late 80s.
So he was still riding the high wave.
I guess it was late 80s, early 90s. It was post Family Ties, but it was like one of those things where it's like, this is my friend Mark, and you turn and go, ah, you know, kind of like, oh my god, you know, and then try to act cool, like, hey, nice to meet you. While inside you're thinking, oh my god, it's Skippy.
Here's a fiver. Keep my car close.
He was very nice. He was a lovely man.
And an attractive man. He
yeah,
was not,
he was
not a bad
guy.
Looking. Because he was a nerd the way that a lot of TV nerds are. They just like stuck some glasses on him and they had him go like, ah, every now and again. And like then. So, you know, did you ever see his stand up, speaking of comedy?
I have, actually.
Now maybe it's
wretched.
See, now I remember it not being that bad, but then again, maybe I'm remembering falsely. Maybe I'm putting like a retrospective sheen of like I wanted it not to suck, or I want to think that he was better at it.
No,
but I guess he's gone, so you know.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, your career starts to flag, so you just sort of cling to whatever you think would be a decent, you know, cursory step.
Right.
You know, the only joke that I really remember him doing was somebody yelled out Skippy from the audience. He's like, no, I'm not Skippy. I'm Skippy's evil twin, Jif.
Okay, that's funny.
Yeah.
Probably prepared in advance, but funny.
Yeah.
The one funny line, this is the most niche conversation anybody has ever had. The one funny joke that Mark Price had in his stand-up routine is, go. The only line I can ever remember is that, and this is a really, really great line that I have stolen because, as you said, some guy in Tuscaloosa is not using it.
Yep.
It shouldn't go to waste. So I have used this, and I like to think that I gave him credit, but I probably haven't. He was the one who actually said that Todd Bridges went from shooting a series to a series of shootings.
Yeah.
Which I thought was funny. And I said, well, that's really, really great. What else do you have? And then apparently the answer was like nothing after that. But he did this movie Trick or Treat where,
yes.
And in Trick or Treat, on Halloween, he played a record by his favorite recently dead rock star named Nuke backward, and then Nuke came back from the dead and wreaked havoc, and then at the end had to be stopped by somebody or other, and Ozzy Osbourne played a preacher. And the music was all done by Fastway.
Yes.
That's the only thing I remember about that
movie.
The
only thing. Wow.
Well, it's many things, I guess.
Captain Vague.
It's a lot of things.
Yeah. But you now have to distinguish that movie from that Trick or Treat movie, the Bryan Singer joint that came out, I guess, a year or 2 years ago, so which I guess is all for the good. Were we doing a thing? Did I open something here and then have to close it?
No. That was the whole Ozzy Osbourne being blamed for the traffic.
There you go. That happened. Story. All right. Sorry about that. Let's do one more here, and then we'll have today's insubordinate humor me.
Let's do our snuff watch.
Here is your snuff watch for Friday, December 31st, 2010. Do we think this is the last death of the year? I mean, we've got like another, I don't know, 9 hours or so on the West Coast.
I don't know.
Hey, let me just, because, you know, here's the, let me just ask you this before we roll the snuff watch. Before we roll the snuff watch proper, I will say that, you know, one of the things that we haven't done much of this year or this week, I guess, with this iteration of the show, we haven't done a lot of, like, you know, year-end, like, look-backs and retrospectives on the year 2010. Because just because you figure that, especially now, what with the internet and all, that it's like, that's just a thing people don't need.
No.
Because, A, I mean, you can argue that there's more of a need for it because nobody remembers anything that happened last week, much less like in January. But also because the internet is just like one big retro machine. That's all it is. The internet is just like one big, like, You know, it's just like one ongoing electronic version of Hal Sparks talking to you about something quirky that happened, like, you know, way back when. So we didn't really do like the top 10 things that happened this year, like, you know, 2010's most shocking OMGs, because it's like, who cares? But here's one thing that I am always interested in, which is the. And we usually have this discussion when the Oscars come up, but it's the whole dead parade of, you know, the celebrities.
Oh, yeah.
Because the thing is, there's always people who died, and it's like you completely forgot about it. Or you thought they died like 5 years ago. So without looking it up, Dawn.
No, I was just, okay. I'm sorry. I don't know who died. No, I was just going to say, if you wanted to go, I think that that one entertainment news briefs thing that I get, I know they had a thing about engagements and marriages through the years. I was just wondering if they had a thing about a roundup of death.
Well, I do at some point.
Roundup of death.
That's
the most awesome rodeo ever.
That's when they not only kill the weeds, they go after their families as well.
How do buckaroos?
We should actually do that here in a second, but before we looked it up online, I wanted to see if we could actually remember it, or if we could without the assistance of the internet, without the training wheels of the World Wide Web, if we could come up with anybody significant who had died this year and who the most significant death was.
Let me think.
Okay, see, that's just ridiculous. That, like, the three of us who were presumably – we were presumably here –
yeah,
for at least half the year, covering said
deaths. Blake Edwards died just a couple of weeks ago.
Last week, actually.
Yeah, so I can remember that.
George Steinbrenner?
That's okay. See, there you go. George Steinbrenner.
See, this is why I have the internet. That way I don't have to remember things ever.
Was there somebody from Captain Kangaroo that died?
Did Mr. Green Jeans die?
No.
Or the postman guy?
No.
No.
The postman guy. You're thinking of Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers.
All right. Mr. Moose died. From Captain Kangaroo.
We had to be euthanized, sadly. He bit a camper.
He had a cancerous antler.
It seems like every year there's a musician who overdoses, and it's like a huge tragedy, and then you forget about it instantly.
Yeah.
Like the drowning pool guy, you know? It's like you just, what a waste. He had his whole life ahead of, what's that? You know, and then you just like you see something else and you just distract
it. Jingle keys.
Boney M. just died. Yeah, I didn't know who he was either.
Boney M, is he one of the Bone Thugs and Harmony members?
Apparently, he was very big in like Britain, in like the early 80s.
I think he might have been a New Bohemian.
No, there was a guy. You know, speaking of that, one of the guys from Boyzone died. I think that Britpop band, the sort of Take That type band.
I came from a candlelight vigil for him, actually. Well,
that's just retarded that we can't think of it. Okay, so we'll have to look it up later. All right, well, let's do it. Here's your snuff watch, though, for Friday, December 31st, 2010. I got the list here.
Oh, okay, good.
I got the list of celebrity deaths. I'll scroll through them and see if we can come up with
them. Okay.
All right.
Geraldine Hough Doyle, the woman who became the poster girl for American working women during World War II, has died at age 86 in Lansing, Michigan.
We know her as?
The We Can Do It woman on the iconic poster.
With a big forearm.
Yes.
Big
Rosie the Riveter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Rosie the Riveter was a clarion call for women to aid the war effort by entering the workforce while the men in their communities went to fight the war abroad. The poster, designed by graphic artist J. Howard Miller, was only displayed for a couple of weeks in a single factory in the Midwest, but was rediscovered during the 1970s and 80s and became popularized as a symbol of what working women can accomplish.
Now, I didn't know that.
Neither did I.
It only came back in the 70s. I figured it had never gone away because it's so freaking cool. I mean, it really is like one of the all-time great images, and not just because we've seen it a million times. I think we've seen it a million times because it's so powerful, because it's like, it is like a weird blend of like femininity and strength, you know.
Yeah.
And it's because she's got the great like flexed arm, but then but it also looks like a real person. I mean, she looks, you know, which apparently she was. I didn't know she was based on a real woman.
Yeah, she was. Rosie the Riveter was inspired by a photograph of Doyle taken while she worked at a factory as a metal presser in Inkster, Michigan.
Fantastic.
Incidentally, Doyle ended up quitting that job shortly after the photo was taken because of its potential dangers. Doyle only recognized herself as the inspiration for the poster after seeing it in a magazine in 1982.
Oh, wow.
That's crazy.
The face was hers, but the muscles weren't, according to her daughter. Her daughter told the New York Times, she was a glamour girl. The arched eyebrows, the beautiful lips, the shape of the face, that's her.
How great is that? And by the way, can I just tell you this? That I used Rosie the Riveter. I leveraged the death of this one. What was her name?
Geraldine Hoff Doyle.
Geraldine Hoff Doyle. So I leveraged her. I leveraged her death to get my wife to do something last night. Because well, she was up and she was
okay,
like,
"Okay, this is gonna be good."
No, she was just like, she was playing Xbox or something, and I was like, "Baby, you gotta go to sleep, don't you?" Because she had to because she was supposed to go work out this morning because she's been, you know, we've been on that holiday slack thing, and we're trying to, like, you know, we don't want to do the thing of waiting till the first of the year because it's like we talked about this where it's like after, like, when you're holiday eating, you reach a certain critical mass where your body's like, no more, you know, and it's like you just feel like I've got to eat something green and leafy, and I have got to at least walk outside into the sun because your body just feels like filled with just fat and laziness. And so, you know, and she's a much better person than I am in that she exercises and she has a whole, like, you know, she has a whole yoga jazzercise thing that she does. But she hadn't gone for a while. And she was going to go this morning. But then, you know, last night I see it's like midnight. She's still awake. I'm like, baby, you got to go to sleep. You're going to go to a jazzercise in the morning. She's like, oh, I don't really know that I'm going to go. And I just, and I said, you know who would want you to go is Geraldine Hoff Doyle. And she said, who's that? And I said, she's Rosie the Riveter. And she died this morning in New Jersey. And oh, she'd geez. Say that you can do it, Laura. And it's like, and she actually just, and she looked at me with the controller. And she said, are you effing with me? And I said, I'm not. And she said, well, God damn it, now I have to go. And she, like, turned off the thing and angrily went off to bed. That poster, though, of the We Can Do It, is right up there with – it's weird because it's almost like a twin image with the nurse being kissed in Times Square by the sailor, who I think they also identified that woman like 5-6 years ago, and she had no idea that it was her. But it's a great thing, and it's so perfect that it came back out in the 70s because that was like the time of the ERA and the push for women's rights and so forth. And it's just – and it really is – you know, in the best sense of the word, a very all-American sort of picture.
It is.
And I think it's a thing that is just like it crosses all cultural boundaries. I don't know anybody that doesn't think that the Rosie the Riveter image is awesome and a representative of a certain fantastic slice of Americana. It makes you wonder, though, how it was rediscovered. Like, if it was only in a single factory for, like, you know, a couple weeks or whatever, like, where did they find it again in the 70s?
I don't know. I don't know. Sometimes people, they do – dig up these old posters, particularly in the 70s and 80s. There was a lot of business in reproducing old retro images from World War II.
Desiderata. So. That was the other one in the 70s that, like, I think that was from, like, 1940 or something, and then it just vanished, and then, like, some guy found it, some hippie found it and started cranking it out, you know, at his, like, print shop in San Francisco or something, and then it immediately just flooded the market.
Oh, that bastard.
Yeah, and the other one, here's the other one I remember. I remember the Desiderata poster and the God Don't Make Junk poster, which seemed to be in, like, every school everywhere. All right, so there you go, Rosie the Riveter. Before we close out the Snuff Watch, let me read a couple of these. We'll see if you guys can suss this out. So I got the 2000 deaths list open here. So I will scroll down here. Let's see who leaps off the page as being significant. Because, you know, the thing is, it's like that. Do you ever do this too, where you look back at the dead parade and you realize that, like, that you don't even really remember, you know, half the people who died, and you're looking. You have to go back and try to figure out why it is that you cared about them in the first place. All right, celebrities who died in 2010, notable deaths. Let's see if I'll do a clue here.
Do we have like game playing music?
No, yeah. Because I realize quickly that any clues I could give would just give it away. But I will say this. I'll list off the ones that you should have remembered and that I should have remembered. First of all, because they were all just like 3 weeks ago. Barbara Billingsley, who I know we talked about. Let's see. Corey Haim died this year, which I
forgot about that.
See,
yeah.
And that's the thing is, so did I. I mean, I think we all did. I flat out forgot about it. Let's see. Dennis Hopper.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Dixie Carter. Dino De Laurentiis.
Oh, yes.
We talked about him at length. Doug Feiger from The Knack. Eddie Fisher. Fess Parker. George Steinbrenner. Gloria Stewart from Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. J.D. Salinger. This one, okay, we ought to be taken out, and we ought to be hung by our pop culture heels and beaten until we are black and blue. Gary Coleman died this year.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
We fail on every level. Let's see, John Forsyth. Let's see.
That was this year.
Lena Horne. Lynn Redgrave. Let's see who else. We are also
God.
We're nearly
that God died.
We're nearly at the end. Peter Graves died this year. Parnell Roberts from Trapper John M.D. died this year. I don't even remember that happening. That apparently happened earlier this year. I guess that was in February. Robert Culp died this year. Robert B. Parker died this year.
I don't think I knew that.
I have brought shame on my entire family. I have brought shame on everyone who has ever known me or listened to me. And so have you, James Willig, because you just referenced him. Ronnie James Dio died this year.
Oh, my God.
Carried off by a dragon to the gray, to the gray veil. I
counter with the fact that you cannot kill Dio. You can only redirect him. He is like energy.
He will become more powerful than you could possibly imagine.
He's like a blue ghost.
Goddamn Rue McClanahan died this year.
Oh, yeah.
Tom Bosley died this year. Teddy Pendergrass died. When did that happen?
Oh,
my God.
The
they snuck that one by us. Tony Curtis died this year.
Yes. Tony Curtis and Eddie Fisher.
And finally, Zelda Rubinstein.
Oh,
yeah. Zelda. So there you go.
Another of my brushes with fame, by the way.
You met Zelda Rubinstein?
I met Zelda Rubinstein.
Really?
I was at a vegetarian restaurant in Los Angeles, and I was sitting with my stepbrother and my then husband, and Zelda Rubinstein was sitting right at the next table, and I was trying to be really, really super cool because she was only just
what
a foot and a half away from him. Probably about 1991.
Okay,
maybe?
So 7 or 8 years after Poltergeist.
Yeah. And my stepbrother kept leaning over to me and going, "This house is clean," in my ear. And I was like, shut up. And I kept hitting him. And then she looked over and she was like, we got our food. She's like, "Oh, that looks delicious. What is that?" And then I just was talking to her, just going, "Oh my God, I'm talking to Zelda Rubinstein." It was awesome.
These forks are clean.
did you reference Poltergeist in any way? Or did you?
No, I just told her what it was. We ordered the, butternut squash ravioli or something. "Oh, that looks delicious." Thanks. And I think I said my standard thing in such a way. I think I said something like, "By the way, I love your work." And she's like, "Oh, thank you.
You're so sweet." Now, yeah. I know she was in other things. I used to be able to name the other film that she had been in, but it is now completely lost to me. Well, I mean, I know she did a lot of things, but it was I was able to do no, she wasn't just in Poltergeist. She was in, Looking Smarter Than I Was by referencing one other movie. And I no longer remember what it was, but I do remember that she was on the Donna Mike show. They did a thing, when we used to do Mystery Guest, and they did a thing sort of like that. I forget what their variation on it was, but they did a sort of Mystery Guest type thing, and she was the Mystery Guest at one point. And, I mean, that was in 2007, and she was still just fantastic. I mean, she was just completely adorable. And I don't think she had anything to push. She wasn't selling anything. She was just they asked her to be on, and she wasn't. And I think she was in ill health then, but she sounded really, really she sounded really, really great and just happy to be there. So, and then and the thing about Zelda Rubinstein is she's that person where, nobody would probably know her name. And nobody, I wasn't even aware that she died, I don't think. But it's that is the role that if you mention, she's the old lady from Poltergeist. Everybody across generations, across time, everybody knows who she is. So, all right, there's your year-end snuff watch for 2010.
Sitting here thinking of just the oddness of the reveals on this show. We've established that I never saw AC/DC or Bon Jovi in concert, but I have met Zelda Rubinstein and Skippy
yeah.
for Family Ties.
Well, I mean, and that's the great thing about this program is one never knows what information one is going to be greeted with. It is an always unfolding panoply of delights and surprises. All right, in just a moment, we'll do a Humor Me Comedy 101 with Mr. Big Jim Willig. Let me just flail for a moment. That's what this is. This is just flat out freaking flailing.
I'm flailing and, away.
And so forth. All right. As we approach the end of the year, I do want to say that we want to thank a whole lot of folks for helping to make this show possible. Of course, all of you out there, every subscriber, everybody who's listened to the show, everybody who's spread the word about the show, everybody who has told somebody else, everybody who took a sort of gamble on the program, you know, as it was getting ready to launch, and everybody who's been listening since then. I also want to thank all of our business partners, and that leads me into this email. This is why I love the audience, by the way, because this email, the subject line is, "Don't ignore this email, you jackass." This comes from Dan. Says, "Rick, I just wanted to say thanks for embedding the name Squires Electric into my head over the past many months. I have also recently entered the smug fraternity known as Small Business Owner, and getting to haughtily finger wag on a host of socioeconomic issues is a welcome benefit. What's also satisfying," he says, listen carefully now, is finding vendors like Squires Electric who rise above the vast morass of mediocre businesses who act bothered and annoyed by the fact that you actually want to pay them to work for you. Squires Electric," this unsolicited testimonial continues, "did three jobs for me." I had to be calling Squires and reading this to them over the phone.
Really?
"Did three jobs for me over the past 3 months at my new exercise facility," which I will say, it's called the Green Micro Gym, Belmont, located in the heart of Belmont Business District. "All done with speed, professionalism, and affordability," he says, without prompting. "Every electrician from Squires Electric," he says, without being urged to do so by Rick Emerson, "who came to my site was incredibly cool and nice. It is also worth noting, in an unsolicited manner, that Squires did my last job on very, very short notice. Why? Because I went into the office to pay my first bill in person, and Donna later said she squeezed in my task because she got to meet me in person and liked the way I looked." So he says, "Thanks for acknowledging Squires Electric. They were a great company." He says, "It is satisfying to find businesses like Squires who rise above the vast morass of mediocre businesses. I would never have known about them if it wasn't for you." And by the way, he then adds at the end in all caps, I am reading now directly from the email written to us last night this morning by listener Dan. "Attention advertisers, I never would have found Squires Electric if not for the Rick Emerson Show. Contact the Rick Emerson Show immediately."
Wow.
So there you go. That is so thank you. That is listener Dan. So that's like a two for one there.
Yeah.
So that is an acknowledgement of Squires Electric, how great they are. And it's, you know, a plug for that guy's business.
And the power of this broadcast.
And also the ever-reaching, always unfolding, always astounding, never-to-be-underrated power of the Rick Emerson radio program. So so we thank you all for not just, you know, for not just listening. But also for when the opportunity arises, you know, keeping your business with, you know, with our sponsors who are themselves listeners to the show and all that. So anyway, so there you go. If you want to find out how to advertise, by the way, you can go to rickemerson.com. You just click on the contact button and you get all the information you could ever need right there. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Show. And now, without further ado, it is time to introduce Mr. Big Jim Willig, who will have your year-end edition of Humor Me Comedy 101.
Thank you very much, Rick Emerson. And welcome, everyone, to Humor Me Comedy 101. In the music world, the popular vote goes to Clapton for God. If this is true, then George Carlin must be God's older, cooler brother from whom Clapton procured his drugs. Every comedian wants to be great, greater than or more great than George Carlin. But once you have become the measure by which others are graded, you are somehow out of the game. You're above it, beyond it. Carlin is a universal constant, like energy or fat gym teachers. Carlin's words touched everything in creation, from the mundane like airline travel and stuff, to the more prolific like religion and death. George spoke with the wisdom of a scholar, the gentleness of a clergyman, and at times the language of a disgruntled longshoreman with Tourette's. So it's easy to see why Carlin gets the vote, the comedy vote, for God. But being a God is exhausting. The constant crushing weight to be the greatest at anything is enough to drive a man insane. My favorite episode of The Twilight Zone has always been A Game of Pool, and deals exactly with this. The legendary pool player Fats Brown is summoned from his untouchable pedestal as the greatest to take a challenge from a young unknown upstart Jesse Cardiff, looking to topple a giant. I won't ruin the ending for you, but the lesson is always the same. Once you've achieved the summit of anything, only then are you truly alone. So I felt it fitting in 2010 as it grinds to a close that we honor the man, not the god, and finally give George some much-needed rest. And with that, I turn the spotlight to my two other people sharing the studio with me at this time, Mr. Rick Emerson and Miss Dawn Taylor. Your thoughts on some guy named George Carlin.
I'll say, first of all, props on the Game of Pool reference. Which,
thank you.
There's that line about, it says something about, you know, you're a big, overstuffed balloon, and I've got the pin.
Yeah.
And he holds up the pool cue. I don't even know. I almost feel like I should let Dawn go first, because I feel like if I start talking about Carlin, I'll never stop, so.
One of the things about Carlin that is significant, that I first think of when I think about him, is that he was just so smart.
Yeah.
And that he managed to do that great stand-up comedy thing of making all of the very specific things he talked about seem universal. But at the same time, he was so smart. He talked about philosophy. He talked about history. He talked about language. And he never, ever seemed like he was talking down to the audience. It was like he treated the audience as if they were as smart as he was.
Yeah.
And that, you know, all of these things that drive all of us crazy, being the smart people that we are. And that's quite a trick, because he was actually talking about some... When you look at a lot of stand-up comedy today, you look at your Larry the Cable guys,
yeah,
who are like going for this lowest common denominator, and Carlin kept it way, way up here.
Yeah.
And the only... later comedians like Bill Hicks, who came along, and even now like Eddie Izzard, who talk about really smart things to the audience and treat the audience as if they're as smart as he is. I think a lot of that goes back to Carlin. It really does.
Absolutely.
Like somebody like Bill Cosby talked about sort of universal experiences of kind of like a working class, middle class sort of a family lifestyle. And Carlin was sort of about the mind. He was about ideas. And I always really loved that about his stuff.
The thing about Carlin is, I could go on and on and on. I would say that to me, Carlin is, he's you nail it. He's the gold standard. I mean, for my money, pound for pound, is just the best there has ever been in the world of stand-up, certainly. And stand-up is its own kind of writing. So, I mean, if you want to describe him as a writer, it's primarily of comedy, but as a writer, he really is, he's just untouchable. He's just matchless. And the weird thing about Carlin is that he's... It's funny, because one of those things on the net, there's this thing where everything that goes around on the net that they can't find an author for, they attribute to George Carlin.
Yeah.
Like every, like, idiotic...
Or Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, or it's like how every novelty song they think is weird by Weird Al. Every idiotic, like, letter to the editor, or, like, somebody's, like, some moron will write some, like, you know, jingoistic editorial screed somewhere, and it'll get tagged as, like, George Carlin says it like it is. And then it's all just something about brown people. But one of the things that floats around the net that is attributed to him that he did not write, but which is sort of strangely fitting, there's this piece that is actually pretty well written, about how in an ideal world you would age in reverse, that you would start off old and that you would end your life as just, you know, as a tiny creature who was filled with wonder at everything, just sort of floating. And it's actually a pretty sweet thing, but he didn't write it, and he was at great pains. One of the great things on his site at georgecarlin.com was always when he was alive, he would keep a running list of things on the internet, you know, he was called S I didn't write, and it would just like be a list of things that he was credited as having written but had not. But the strange thing about that piece is he didn't write it, but it does describe his career. Because if you go back and you look at early Carlin stuff, he's sort of like Willie Nelson in that he started off as a sellout. And then he worked backward to being the edgy, rough and tumble the comedian who was sort of an outlaw and didn't care about getting a development deal anywhere.
Yeah, because in the early days, he started out, you know, he wore a suit and tie. Yeah. He had the short hair. He did the hippy-dippy weatherman as a making fun of the counterculture kind of a person.
And
then he became that kind of counterculture guy himself.
And he was doing mainstream television shows.
Yeah.
And it's not like the comedy was bad. I mean, it was, you know, he was still very funny, but it was not the Carlin that we sort of, he wasn't in full flower. It was not the Carlin that I think would resonate with people the way that it did later on when he began getting into edgier material. And the other thing about Carlin that is just astounding is that, again, in my assessment, if you look at his work, it gets better every year. I mean, he got better as he got older. And with the exception of the first special he did when he got out of rehab in 2005, which is still good. It's not great. It's still good, though. With the exception of that special, everything he did was better than the thing he had done before. He continued to raise the bar on himself and to up the ante in terms of quality and in terms of honing it. The other thing about Carlin is he didn't just find a style and stick with it. If you watch Carlin in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, they are all very different and distinct in terms of their delivery. The 60s were all about, as you said, he was very buttoned up and very straight-laced and clean-shaven and was a very establishment type of comic. In the 70s, it was a sort of whimsical kind of drug-fueled comedy where it was not free-form, but it had a sort of jazzier feel to it. It did have a sense of sort of childlike whimsy. The 80s were an era when he got much more scatological in his comedy, but at the same time, he was pairing it with a more traditional setup, punchline sort of delivery. But he was also starting to fold in many more of the things like observations on linguistics and cultural behavior patterns. And then in the 90s, that is when he did a special called, I believe it was the Back in Town special, which he had done after a protracted absence, because his deal was that he did a special every single year for HBO. And I think he went 2 or 3 years without doing it. And then when he came back, it was a show called Back in Town. And that is the first time you saw Carlin with gray hair, ponytail, and then dressed in black from head to toe. And that was like his last great reinvention. And really, from my way of thinking, is really where he actually just stripped his comedy down to its bare essence. And it became like a sort of like a Rick Rubin production, where it was stripped down to the bare minimum, but then turned as loud as he possibly could get it.
Yeah.
And there was also a whole, almost a new rhythm to the way he spoke at that point, too. It's like, because he's another one of the comics that, like you said, jazz earlier, there was always a very musical almost rhythm to his delivery of his stuff. You could almost hear it as music, that he had his timing down to like just a beat, 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 beat thing in his own head. And at the end, it was like there was this sort of, it was almost like this sort of rage-fueled, angry kind of beatbox jazz that he was doing towards the end.
Well, and he was a guy, he knew exactly what syllable needed to come at the end of a sentence, exactly how many words you could put in a row before you had to stop, and exactly what kind of rhythm you had to use to get the audience on your side. I'll play just a little bit, and I should say at this point that there's a whole bunch of stuff we sort of gathered this. You have the Hippy Dippy Weatherman, and we'll play a bit of that, and then probably in lieu of the second piece, there's something actually I want to play here.
By all means.
That we'll get to in just a second. I will say this, too, about Carlin, that spontaneity is really overrated in some ways, because I think there's a perception sometimes that comics just go on stage and they just sort of riff on whatever comes into their head. And there are certainly people that work with blueprints or they work with outlines. Eddie Izzard seems to do that. If you see his subsequent shows, like if you see him back to back in the same city, or if you see him back to back in different cities using kind of the same material, the structure is there, but he hangs a lot of different things on that, you know, on that tree. Carlin, though, I've seen Carlin live. I don't know, I saw him live 4 or 5 times, and I had the pleasure of seeing him do the same set 3 different times in 3 different places. I saw him, because you know the thing is that comics go on the road or they hone the material from city to city.
Oh, yeah.
I saw him do a set in Portland, and then later in that same tour, this would have been 2004 maybe, that same tour I saw him do the same act in Vegas at the MGM. Then I saw him do, because the deal was always the same. He would start out with the material on the East Coast. He would go all the way to the West Coast. He'd go all the way back, and then he would end it performing in New York, and that would be the HBO special for that year. So I saw him do the material in Portland, then in Vegas a few months later. Then I saw it finally turn up on HBO about a year and a half from then. And the amazing thing about it was just astounding. Having seen him do the same material 3 times in 3 different venues over the course of a year, some of it was changed, but that was more with editing and cutting things out. All of his pauses and his hesitations and his stammers were exactly in the same place every time, which indicated that they were scripted, that they were not, that it wasn't a thing where when he looked at like he was searching for a word. There's this great moment where he talks about the ongoing evolution of language to be softer and meaningless. How we don't say shell shock anymore; we say post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah. And if you see the little segment where he goes, and he said, "Well, this is all part of the softening. It's all part of the pussification of America," and he does that pause and that little like he's hunting for the word in his head exactly the same way every single date on that tour.
He knows how to draw you in slowly. I mean, to look at it from the abstract, this point of view, he's like very much like a spider. You know, he doesn't have to come at you and attack you. Once he's got you fully engrossed in what he's talking about, he can do whatever he wants. And it looks effortless, but you're right. Having that structure, having that blueprint in place, it, you know, the masters make it look like it's like it's just happening right now.
Right. That's the I mean, and that's, you know, it's that way with I've talked to radio guys about Stern before in Stern Show, and there's this belief, I think, among a lot of the audience and among a lot of radio hosts who have come after Howard Stern, that he would just be a guy who walks in with like a post-it note with one word on it as his show prep. When in fact, if you listen to the Stern Show and if you know anything about the internal workings of that show is oftentimes just this side of scripted, which I don't say is a knock. I mean, it's like show, you know, show prep is important and you got to do what you got to do to make it work. But there's so many people on that show that they structure it, you know, well in advance of going on the air, but they still make it sound like everything is happening in the moment, which is really to their credit. I'll play just a little something here from Carlin. So this is our year-end installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 with Jim Willig. I'll just play a bit of this, actually, just to illustrate that what you are hearing right here is, I believe, at this he was how old when he died? He was
71?
71, 72?
Yeah.
This was, I think, just about 18 months beforehand. So realize that you are, I mean, think about the guys in your family who are like, you know, 60, you know, or just some doddering, crusty-ass relative of yours who can barely remember where their car keys are, you know, or, you know, by the time lunchtime hits, they're a little foggy about what they had for breakfast. Realize that you are now listening to a, I believe, just about to turn 71-year-old man right here.
I'm a modern man, a man for the millennium, digital and smoke-free, a diversified multicultural postmodern deconstructionist, politically, anatomically, and ecologically incorrect. I've been uplinked and downloaded, I've been inputted and outsourced, I know the upside of downsizing, I know the downside of upgrading. I'm a high-tech lowlife, a cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, bi-coastal multitasker, and I can give you a gigabyte in a nanosecond. I'm new wave, but I'm old school, and my inner child is outward bound. I'm a hot-wired, heat-seeking, warm-hearted, cool customer, voice-activated and biodegradable. I interface with my database is in cyberspace, so I'm interactive, I'm hyperactive, and from time to time, I'm radioactive. Behind the eight ball, ahead of the curve, riding the wave, dodging the bullet, pushing the envelope. I'm on point, on task, on message, and off drugs. I got no need for coke and speed. I got no urge to binge and purge. I'm in the moment, on the edge, over the top, but under the radar. A high-concept, low-profile, medium-range ballistic missionary. A streetwise smart bomb. A Top Gun bottom feeder. I wear power ties. I tell power lies. I take power naps. I run victory laps. I'm a totally ongoing Bigfoot slam dunk rainmaker with a proactive outreach.
Now realize, by the way, again, that's a guy who's 70-something and has spent, you know, at this point about three decades destroying as many of his brain cells as possible with any number of substances. Also, that we're not even a third of the way through that and that the rhythm and the tempo of it only increases as he gets toward the end. It is one other piece that is similar
to
that.
It's musical. It's almost lyric.
And it's like it's what Don said about the rhythm of it. I'll play just a bit of something else that is similar in tone. This is called Advertising Lullaby.
This next thing is about advertising. And by the way, if you should have any cognitive dissonance,
let's see. You're just gonna... so this is from his New York special in '99.
This is called Advertising Lullaby. Keeping in mind, of course, that the whole purpose of advertising is to lull you to sleep. Quality, value, style, service, selection, convenience, economy, savings, performance, experience, hospitality, low rates, friendly service, name brands, easy terms, affordable prices, money-back guarantee, free installation. Free admission, free appraisal, free alterations, free delivery, free estimates, free home trial, and free parking. No cash, no problem, no kidding. No fuss, no muss, no risk, no obligation, no red tape, no down payment, no entry fee, no hidden charges, no purchase necessary, no one will call on you, no payments or interest till September.
So the whole piece, it goes on for about 4 minutes, and it's just him stringing together all of these cliches and things that you've just heard a jillion times during advertising. There's no actual jokes contained there. There's no punchline. There's no real payoff, except that at the end he turns into a sort of a longer observation about the nature of advertising and commerce in America. It's just that he saw what nobody else was able to see, which is the way that these phrases are sort of recurrent and the way that they are kind of hyperlinked in our culture, and had the idea to take them all out and string them together into this sort sort of weird poetry. But then, as you noted, done with this sort of weird aggro, like New Jersey sort of delivery that makes it all. And here's the other thing about Carlin, and this, you know, is that Carlin is sort of, we were talking about, I guess, AC/DC earlier, and I was saying how they, you know, they're critic proof because every year there's a new kid who discovers them. Carlin is kind of similar in the sense that, you know, everybody loved George Carlin. Intellectuals loved him, and, you know, and blue-collar guys loved him, and rich folks loved him, and poor folks loved him, and The New Yorker loved him, and Rolling Stone loved him, and High Times loved him. That there was he was a comedy, not even just a Rorschach. It's just that he had so many.
He was a media darling.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, he could stand there and spit at you, you know, and just talk about how much, you know, you're full of BS or this, that, and the other. And people would love him all the more because he was real. He wasn't doing this because he wanted your exception or he wanted your attention or he wanted your, you know, affections. He did this because, I don't know if he felt that the world needed to be, you know, just a little bit more with it or a little bit more, you know, eyes open. But he clearly saw the man behind the curtain and was doing his best to rip that thing off its, you know, its shingles and show the people around him that some of this is jokes, but for the most part, I'm teaching you something.
There also never seemed to be any kind of a sense that he was playing a character.
No.
And that's the sense you get with an awful lot of stand-up comics, that, yes, there is, you know, you want to feel that there's an honesty to the comedy, to what they're saying. But at the same time, I think you usually, there's a tacit understanding that they are playing a role.
Right.
That we are seeing an aspect of them as a whole person. And with Carlin, it honestly always seemed like this was George Carlin just getting up on the stage and talking to you.
And I think that's a result, again, of him starting by being such a mainstream, family-friendly comic and realizing that he just couldn't do that,
yeah.
That it just didn't work, and that the only choice he had was to sort of, you know, was just kind of to be himself. One of the most brilliant pieces I ever saw him do was when he was here in Portland, the last time I saw him in Portland, and he did this brilliant bit where over the course of about 15 minutes, you know, he was sort of like, you mentioned seeing The Social Network and how one of the genius of Aaron Sorkin is that he can take something that is fundamentally dull or dry or uninteresting and reduce it into something or transmogrify it into something that is entertaining and compelling. He can make it dazzle. And Carlin was able to take this long discussion of the Ten Commandments and the sort of, and the kind of etymological and linguistic problems posed by them and their internal inconsistencies and hypocrisies. And over the course of, I don't know, however long this bit was, you know, like 10,
just about 10 minutes.
12, 15 minutes, he shows how you can reduce the Ten Commandments down to one.
Yeah.
And I forget exactly what the roadmap was, but at the end he goes, there you go, you got one commandment, that's all you need, you're set. And it was like a very logical chain of hilarious observations that all, but they all held together intellectually.
Yeah.
And it was just, and you think to yourself, like, well, who does that? Like, what is going on in your head? Like, what is in your brain that you're able to visualize that, to get the idea, and then to actually make it work, and on top of it, to make it funny?
See, a lot of times people will take Carlin and sort of, like I said, hoist him onto a pedestal upon which, you know, it's impossible to even sort of associate them in any way as being an actual person, when in all actuality, he was probably more real of a person than anybody else, right, really around you. So it makes you think that maybe he was the only real person, and all we are is kind of like just like window dressing or like some kind of other, you know, entity in the room. He is the actual, you know, human sort of wandering around, questioning authority, questioning this, that, and the other, not letting everything around him sort of force him into a specific pigeonhole. He was just sort of kicking holes in the world around him, and people just loved him for it.
Well, that was the other thing about Carlin, is that he so obviously just, you know, it's not that here's the thing about Carlin, is that he cared about the audience, but he cared about the audience, he cared about the audience the way that a performer should, which is that he cared enough to create a quality product and to craft quality entertainment for them, but he also realized that the only way you can really do that is by not thinking about them. It's just by doing what you think is good and what you think is funny, and you know what amused him and what he felt was good comedy. And you couldn't just do it like it was a focus group or something. And so that's why when he would go out on stage, this is why I have, I think, so much difficulty with comedy, with stand-up comedy and comedians as a rule, because when you see a guy like Carlin, it's like seeing such a deconstruction of the form and seeing so much, you know, something was so much the genuine article that everything else just seems like a facade. Everything else rings false. And it's because you got the sense that he was a guy, he just didn't care what you thought. He wanted you to be entertained, but he didn't care whether you agreed or not. He didn't care whether you liked him or not. he did not give a rip what the guy in the audience actually felt about him.
But at the same time, though, I mean, so much of his act, to a certain extent, there were different, you know, compartments. There were the bits that he did that were tearing apart the linguistics and the
right.
logic of language, the logics and the and he also discussed at points ethics. He was very outraged by things that were immoral and that were unethical, and he had no problem showing his rage. But he would also modulate that with genuine sweetness. And I think that the other thing is that when you watch him, his routine, when you watch his stand-up specials, he would always manage to end everything on a note of sort of hopefulness, of sweetness. I always got the sense that as angry as he would get about the inequities of the world and the illogic of so much of society, he felt a genuine love for humanity as a whole. He seemed like a genuinely sweet and loving man.
Well, yeah, as much as he made it seem like the world around us was hopeless and just spiraling farther and farther out to a point where there was no hope for it all, at the same time, he did have a genuine, like you said, a genuine, like, you know, need sort of to educate and to sort of, you know, he didn't feel like he needed to share his, you know, his thought process. He wanted you to come up with your own. He wanted you, like it says in the game of pool, he's just like, you know, I set the bar up here. I want somebody else to come along and push it farther. I don't want to be
right.
the best. I don't want to be this god that everyone sees me as. I just want to be a part of a better cog, not the best cog in this box.
He did seem to, he seemed like a guy who really was fascinated by the world. It is clear from seeing Carla that he was a guy who probably enjoyed waking up every day because all of, whether it's humanity or whether it's just, you know, whether you view it as a thing of him loving humanity or just being entranced by this sort of circus parade that constantly goes by, you know, on this planet, every day was just full of bright, glittering objects that he could just sit and ruminate on, and sort of muse about. And he was fortunate enough to be able to do it in a way that was hilarious and that was marketable. And, and he was able to make a living doing that. Somebody actually, they asked him in the Playboy interview, they said, why did you start doing comedy? And he said, well, you know, everybody's got their own reasons for doing comedies. You know, a lot of guys do it to get laid, and that's a fairly good reason. He said a lot of guys do it because they want to make money, and that's, you know, that's a bad reason because it doesn't really work out that way. And, and he said a lot of guys do it because they just want to be able to get their blow somewhere. Also a good reason. But he said that the reason he started comedy, he said he didn't really have any choice. He said, the reason I started doing stand-up, he said, I just had all of this crap in my head that was just like screaming to get out. And so that tells me that there really was a guy who just... he just looked at everything, and everything triggered this avalanche of thoughts in his head. And if you are a guy like that, I mean, there's a finite number of career opportunities open, I think, to people like that. And, you know, anyway, it is really one of those things where you, as we...
I think all three of us can attest to that.
Probably. George Carlin is also... we've spent, like, forever talking about this, but I will say that my final two thoughts, and I swear to God I'll shut up, is that, one... the thing about Carlin that is so powerful is that he simultaneously can be sort of depressing because you think, like, I'll never be that good. I can never do anything that brilliant. I will never be, you know, I will never be able to have such a razor sharp usage of words, you know, as part of my arsenal. On the other hand, he can sort of inspire you because you'd be like, that's what's possible. You know, like, you can make that out of nothing, out of just the words in your head. You can create this, you know, and that it can sort of encourage you. And my second thought is, as I said, on the Facebook or whatever, I think on Christmas, I was watching Emma Dotter's Jug Band Christmas, which is awesome. And I said that, you know, to have lived in a world that had been graced by Jim Henson was a special kind of magic. You know, to have the luck to be born after Jim Henson was born and after he was alive long enough to create that for us, you know, that's a thing that is truly beautiful. And I feel the same way about George Carlin. You know, it's to have lived in a world where you could just, you know, buy a ticket or buy a record or go online and press a button and you get to hear that, you know, is just, I mean, it's just, that's as good as it gets. It just doesn't get any better than that, ever.
Some of the greatest comics that were interviewed after Carlin passed away, a lot of the time the question was, when you talked to Carlin, what was some of the advice that he gave you? And almost all of them said that Carlin was a very big fan of, or if not a believer in, writing every single day. Yeah. Write something. It doesn't have to be genius. It doesn't have to be gold. It doesn't even have to be usable. But write something down because that continues the process going. You know, I really think that, you know, you don't have to take a Da Vincian kind of look at his work. You can really see it for what it is. And if you take the time to really kind of analyze it and see how he analyzed things, then you're right, that bar isn't set at an impossible level. It's just going to take a hell of a lot of work to get up there to it.
I promised I'd be quiet. Don?
I got nothing else. I was hoping we'd hear that hippy-dippy weatherman.
Oh, I've got that, actually. So that was actually I was going to go out with that. So okay. This is George Carlin in 1978 doing one of the routines that that made him famous. We should also add, before I play this, I should say that the other cut, which would have required, I think, so much editing as to render it almost pointless, is the Seven Dirty Words,
yeah.
Which is interesting.
The idea of editing that to play it
is sort of funny.
Yeah.
It's like a seismograph reading.
The great thing about George Carlin and that bit is that very few comedians. I know Stern sort of made some overtures at wanting to do this back when he was fighting with the FCC, but really, it is the rare comedian who can say that they actually changed the course of American legal history.
Yes,
you know, and in the Pacifica case, which is where that Supreme Court case was known, which is about a radio station that played the Seven Dirty Words, and whether or not, because the FCC's rules up to that point had been very. They've been very specific, but as he pointed out, you know, it was also full of holes. And so the Pacifica case is really what gave us what we have now, which is the definition of indecency as terms or descriptions in terms or. It's amazing how fast this knowledge falls out of your head. let's see. Descriptions and terms considered patently indecent by prevailing community standards, organs or activities of a sexual or excretory nature.
Which George would have loved to tear apart.
Which is great because it means nothing. It means nothing and everything, which was his whole point, that every time you try to clarify something, you just lead to further obfuscation. And he made that point. Not only on stage, but actually in the Supreme Court, he was used to. I mean, so he became part of. He became, you know, a thread in the fabric. This is George Carlin in 1978. They're doing the Hippy Dippy Weatherman. If I can wait.
And for the request of a couple of people that are on the crew that listen or look and through viewers or listening on headsets or whatever, and do a little weather forecast from Al Sleep. What's happening? Que pasa? Que what you call your pasa? Al Sleet here, hippy dippy weather man, with all the hippy dippy weather, man. Brought to you by Parsons Pest Control. Do you have termites, water bugs, and roaches? Well, Parsons will help you get rid of the termites and water bugs and help you smoke the roaches. Temperature at the airport is 88 degrees, which is stupid, man, because I don't know anybody who lives at the airport. Now, if you'll take a look at our national weather map, you'll see that we don't have one. So try to picture last night's map in your mind. Remember all the letters and lines, all them little numbers. The weather's dominated by a large Canadian low, which is not to be confused with a Mexican high.
And the thing about that is that it's, you know, if you listen to it now, it seems maybe not tame is the word, but it doesn't seem as edgy as it probably did then. But I mean, it was, I think he was probably taking a big, before the internet, before the explosion of things like cable television and pay TV, I think he was probably taking a pretty big career gamble deciding to do what was then, I think, is it a fairly peripheral comedy and comedy that was out on the edges.
Yes.
And I mean, that I think only happens when a guy decides that he just can't swallow the other thing any longer. You know, that he just can no longer bear to go on stage and go like, two guys walk into a bar, you know, and it's just...
How about women, huh?
I mean,
it wasn't something that he directly started out to do. Like, he didn't want to, like, I'm going to change the world with my comedy.
Right.
Like, it just, like you said, it evolved. And over the better part of 60 years is what he had spent on stage. Well, maybe a little less than 60 years was how long he was entertaining. And, you know, that alone is like, it's more than half a century. And it, to be constant, to not be known as like the same kind of person, to be this ever-changing ball of energy, you know, it goes to show you that, like, he will never go away. His influence is embedded and changed who we are and how we live every day.
I would strongly recommend, by the way, reading his autobiography, which came out last year. Unlike the Bill Bryson book, I would recommend, by the way, skipping the audiobook of Carlin's autobiography because his brother reads it. I believe is Peter, not Peter Carlin. Is it Peter Paul or
Mary Carlin?
Something. Anyway, but his brother, yeah, Zeppo Carlin, reads it. And it's the thing about it, it's like he sounds like Brian Doyle Murray. So it's a lot of like, so anyway, there I was in New Jersey. And it's just like, it's this like, it's like George Carlin's voice, but delivered. I actually had, I powered through about half of it on a long trip, but I had to stop about every 20 minutes and just listen to silence just because it scraped the inside of my ears.
It is actually a good autobiography, and he'd been taking notes for that for years.
Right.
And I guess he had done a lot of work with Tony Hendra,
yeah,
who used to be an editor for National Lampoon, and they had worked on Carlin's comedy together for a long time. And after his death, Hendra like gathered all the notes together and put the book together for him.
Even in the foreword, though, you know, from Beyond the Grave, Carlin is hilarious because he talks about why it's not called a memoir. And he says, you know, so I'm not going to name something that's just me, which is what memoir is. And then you look at the word and you go, me, moi, ha-ha. And it's that thing that was just sitting there for decades and that no one ever commented on, you know, until George Carlin. So there you go. That is a Humory Comedy 101, your year-end edition from Mr. Big Jim Willink. We should ask two things. First of all, Monday is going to be the 3rd. When is your show at Baghdad?
My show is the 14th, which I believe is a Friday, 10 o'clock. Tickets available at McMinimins.com.
And then what are you bringing in next week? What are we starting the year with, or do you know yet?
I haven't quite figured that one out yet. I was leaning in a couple of different
Carrot Top. Oh, come on. Let it be Carrot Top.
I'm saving him for a special, you know, what have you. Carrot Top can be viewed as kind of like a novelty act, but there's a lot of depth to the guy.
I was
not just
say,
his muscular, you know.
I would actually enjoy discussing Carrot Top just because, you know, for the same reason you enjoy discussing, you know, the bad movies or whatever, movies that are at least, because the fact that you mention Carrot Top to people and they immediately go, wah! And they have some sort of thing to say about it indicates that there's certain, he's certainly
exactly
worthy of discussion.
He did bring a prop comedy to a whole new level.
Yes. Plus, he is the biggest, strongest ginger you will ever see in your entire life.
Scary looking.
Scary ginger.
I don't mean this how it sounds. Ask Sarah Dillon about Carrot Top's sexual proclivities.
And on that note.
I'm not saying she has firsthand knowledge, but that was the subject of some discussion on Fun Employment Radio at one point in the recent past. So you might want to ask Sarah Gregg about that.
Done.
They can tell you some stories. All right.
Well, we'll bring Sarah in on Carrot Top Day to share.
It's her dream come true.
I will tell you that in 2011, we are going to be trying to get as diverse as possible. Everything from, like Eddie Izzard, as we discussed earlier, Dave Attell, Louis Black, to Chaplin, to Tim Conway, pretty much Mel Brooks, if you can imagine it as well. If you can think of any others that I might not be able to think of, feel free to hit me up at Facebook.com/Jim Willig, not the guy that looks all buff and muscular with the beard, but the other Jim who's probably doing something embarrassing. Just look for the embarrassing Jim Willig. I'm that guy.
All right. We should pay a visit to the news desk. I know we've got at least a job watch to get through here. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. This is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Well, I do have one before we get to the job watch, so I will share this quickly. A bizarre accident involving a neck massager killed a well-respected South Florida doctor.
I'm sorry, where?
Florida. Police say Dr. Michelle Ferrari Gigerson had just finished wrapping some gifts on Christmas Eve when the 37-year-old then used an electrical massager to relieve her neck pain. But investigators say the device strangled her. Her husband found her unconscious on their bedroom floor. Jim Leljedal of the Broward County Sheriff's Department said the massager got entangled with her necklace and probably caused her to black out very quickly.
Now, do we have any further explication of what kind of neck massager we're talking about here?
Well, I'm thinking if it got entangled with her necklace and strangled her, it must have been one of the ones with like the knobby things that rotate.
Oh, and it just kept like pulling it in like reeling in a fishing line.
Yeah, it must have been
that's unfortunate.
Like that.
Well, it strikes me as something like from the Friday the 13th series where like the cursed items are like secretly killing.
Yeah.
Like it might be something along those lines, something from like a Sharper Image employee killed under mysterious circumstances comes back as a massager.
The thing that surprised me about this story is that somebody actually uses a neck massager on their neck.
Very true.
I didn't realize that.
Well, sell a menagerie of different massagers that are used for various, you know, tension spots.
I mean, you got to figure, though, that, I mean, it's like, look, I've seen some of those massagers, and it's like either they are just for, you know, either they're just for the Donna Simpsons of the world, or they're for use on more than one person simultaneously. But even then, it's like they'd have to be missing their right and left leg, respectively, because they're shaped like hammerhead sharks, some of those things. And it's like, how – I don't even know what you're supposed to do with that.
Yeah.
Anyone?
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't
All right. Know. All right. So neck massager, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
That is by the – that's the very definition of just an accidental death, because that's not a thing that in any like conceivable realm would kill you.
No.
And I wonder, like, do you think like if you died from something like that, didn't kill you outright, didn't kill you instantly, that you would just have a moment to go like, well, this can't be killing me. I can't be dying from this. It's
really,
not even
this
possible.
This is how I go out?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, where you just go, yeah. God damn it. Like, you wonder if David Carradine had that moment of just, you know, of like, you know, and I mean, maybe death was a little more foreseeable in those circumstances. But do you think he just had a moment of going like, I don't have any pants on, crap.
I did actually get to have that experience once when I was coming home from a company picnic and the brakes went out on my giant truck I was driving as I was getting off the freeway. And I went barreling down this off-ramp, and I ended up – so I didn't hit anybody. I just basically swerved the truck and took it off the road, mm-hmm. and it started tumbling sideways. And I was as the car – and it's weird because you hear this thing about having like – even though it's only a couple of seconds, having this clarity of thought because I guess of the adrenaline rush or something. And I distinctly remember as this was happening, I was like going, well, this is probably going to kill me. Really? And it was exactly like that. I was going, this is it? Really? Oh, well, this sucks.
Did you have a list of things you hadn't done yet in your head? You're like, I've never gone to Acapulco as you're sort of...
No, it was really just a matter of like, now?
Ah, crap.
This? Really? Oh, that sucks. And then when it finally came to a stop and I was there and I realized I wasn't dead and then I started moving my limbs around and I went, oh, okay. And then I said, oh, I smell gas. I better get out of here. But it was, but yeah, I literally had that thought of like, oh, God, well, this sucks.
Have you ever done this? Have you ever come, at least in your memory, from close to dying or what, you know, you believe it's close to dying? And at that moment, you know, and especially if it's something where you know, you have a few moments to consider it, you know, like it's the long slide of the car down a hill on an icy, you know, on an icy day, or, you know, the doctor sees like a big spot on your X-ray and then he realizes later it's just, you know, it's like his thumb that happened, you know, it's like a fly that settled on the lens at the wrong moment. But you have a moment to ponder your own mortality, which you believe at that point to be imminent, and you fixate on something really, really stupid and small that you're going to do like tomorrow. You're like, well, I was going to go to Chuck E. Cheese. Crap. Every time I have thought for even a second that I was going to die, I would always think of something utterly ridiculous and minuscule in my life that was on the horizon. Like there was like a, you know, like there was a matinee of like Indian in the Cupboard playing at the you know, at the theater. And I really wanted to see that.
No,
and now
I'll
never
get
to. I still
have a piece of pizza at home.
Yeah.
And it's damn like, it.
I never think about the next 60 years, you know.
You never get to see Joey season 2.
Right. No one gets to see Joey season 2. Here is Don Taylor.
Job watch.
Here's your job watch for the end of the year. This is New Year's Eve 2010.
Minimum wage! Yeah!
Here is Don Taylor with your job watch.
New jobless claims fell to their lowest level since July of 2008 last week, signaling that employers are a little less reluctant to take on new workers. Initial unemployment claims dropped by 34,000 to a mere 388,000.
Huzzah!
Between December 18th and December 25th. Those would be your new jobless claims.
All right.
Fell to a mere 388,000, marking the first time that the number has fallen below 400,000 in more than 2 years.
Progress.
And this is new claims, right?
This is new claims.
Okay, so it's
the old guy got fired.
We never can figure out exactly what this means, though, when they say new claims, because clearly there weren't 400,000 new claims, because I think we figured out that if that were true, then like that would be 17 billion people a year or something.
Well, it's initial unemployment claims. So that means that if you just got fired from a job again, or if you've been out of work long enough that for the laws in your region allow you to reapply, that would count as well.
I guess when they say new claims, they're talking about the weekly filing. That's what they're talking about. They're talking about the weekly filing without an interruption, because there can't be 400,000 new claims a year. That the math on that is just retarded. That would be more people than are on planet Earth within like a few months. So what that means is when they say claim, that's when you file. It's like when you go online and it says file your weekly claim. That is claims that are ongoing without a previous interruption.
I don't think so, because new claims, because claims in total were something like 4,128,000.
Right, but that must, but that's probably, see, that though is people who filed for unemployment, stopped because they got a gig, and then filed for unemployment again.
Yeah.
The new claim is one that has not yet been interrupted by work. So there are only 400,000 or so of those, of people who are filing that have not had that filing interrupted. That has to be the case, because otherwise you just end up with way too many people after just a couple months.
Well, and that's true, because new claims had increased by 57,000 to 4,128,000. The Labor Department officials noted that seasonal hiring and firing can have an impact on the figures. So if you get hired, you know, you go off unemployment, you get hired just for the Christmas season,
right,
to work at IKEA, then the job ends, you go back and reapply for unemployment. That is an initial claim.
Okay, so then, but so that's 380,000 as compared to when? That's my question, though. It's like, what, when you say as opposed to 400,000, well, when was the 400,000? There's no, they don't ever indicate that. That's what makes it so difficult to figure it out. I'm trying to figure out what two periods of time they are comparing. And no matter how many times we hear the story, and we get it about every three or four weeks, I don't know. I mean, I just have no idea. They never, it's frustrating the way that they write this, because they never really indicate what two periods of time they are talking about here. It would be handier if these stories ever were accompanied with like the percentage, because I think we're like, nationally, it's like 9.5 or something. It's like in Portland, it's 10.1 or something like that. So, all right.
Well, this economist fellow named Ryan Sweet, he says that it's a good sign, but people shouldn't get too excited about it.
The big picture is the job market is clearly moving in the right direction. We're still not creating enough jobs to make a dent in this double-digit unemployment rate we have, but you know, we need to walk before we can start running.
You know, the economic recovery isn't Beetlejuice, but everybody sort of treats it that way. Like, if they just – because I think we're going on like a year and a half now of people just saying, no, sunny days are here again, sort of thinking that that will just magically then make it so.
I'm not sure what he means by double-digit economic recovery. Does that mean like,
well, that means
we're
like
up 10 bucks?
When the GDP or when consumer spending goes up like more than 10%.
Oh, okay.
Or 10, more than 9%.
All right. Sweet says the outlook for the next year is a gradual recovery in the labor market.
We expect hiring to accelerate over the next few months. The unemployment rate should likely start to begin to decline noticeably in the second half of next year, but we're likely going to finish 2011 slightly below or at 9%. So we still have a very long ways to go.
You know, what's weird is I've gotten emails from some listeners who have been rejected by temp agencies because the temp agencies are over full.
Okay.
They just got there like, we got more people than we can deal with. Try again like tomorrow, which, you know, and at that point you're basically, it's like you're just standing on a corner waiting for the Steno truck to come by and pick up you and your friends, hoping that you can pick up a little work during the day.
So you like to sell pencils and pens, huh?
See, you know, and it's like, you just, so like, yeah, we've just become a nation of immigrant Kelly girls, you know, just trying to find someplace where we can look. I don't know. I'll get you your bagel, your macchiato. What do you need? Anything?
I do filing.
Yeah.
I do filing for food.
See, now if we were heavy-handed TV writers, we would write some episode in which you were going to like some express personnel temp service, and then as you were rejected, you walked out and across the street you saw a brown person who had just been rejected for his own kind of temp job. Don, only you're going home to a warm bed and a refrigerator full of food, and he's going home to persecution by the government. And then and then at the end, there would be an 800 number that flashed on the screen that urged you to call your congressman to do something about amnesty and immigration laws.
Attention, Joss Whedon, start writing right
just
now.
Just saying, right? If you're lacking something for Boston Public, maybe.
Or I could maybe, out of the goodness of my heart, I could offer to marry him because he has health insurance, but I can, get him a green card. And then we end up falling in love because after he takes a shower, it turns out he's Antonio Banderas.
Like the gift of the Magi.
I have difficulty suspending disbelief once you get to the he has health insurance part.
Well, I know.
Maybe that should be your living. You should just offer to have anchor babies for people. You know? You're not doing anything with your uterus now. I mean, it's, you've got eggs left. I mean, they're just good, you know? Don't throw those away.
My uterus at this point is a barren, rocky place where the sperm can hold no purchase.
Is that true?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Really? Like medically?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
No, I'm
eggless.
Prove it.
I'm egg free.
Be fertile. Right now. Do it.
I didn't know you were completely, you've been de-egged. Was that like was that like as a result of some other procedure?
No, it's just a matter of no. I just
we haven't hit menopause yet.
I don't know.
I mean, but you can't say you don't know to my, about whether you've hit menopause.
About 10 years ago, I had a really bad case of endometriosis, and I had to have everything scraped out. And apparently my uterus is not hospitable to egg laying.
Is endometriosis the thing where you get the it's like the egg is in the fallopian tube?
No, endometriosis is when you get like a buildup of like scar tissue and gunk inside your uterus.
Gunk.
They have to scrape it out.
Well, I wish I could take that question back. All right, but is that just
you asked, baby?
I can't unring a bell.
They have to just power wash everything, and that's a lot of like, well, we got to send the we got to wash everything at the same time.
They go in there with a little miniature sand blaster.
Yeah,
and
it's like you don't have time to. Do you have time to empty out your pockets or anything?
This uterus is as filthy as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Well, so I was going to recommend then that you just. I tried to get Sarah to do this for years, just as like a source of income, and then also for show material. Just to sell her eggs to rich people, and she just didn't want to do it. Yeah. I don't know why. That's another thing that like men and women differ on. Because if guys could just sell their sperm for $3,000, even if you could only do it, even if you could just do it every, once every, 6 months or whatever it is for like the egg selling.
Yeah.
Why every guy on earth would do that?
See, I'm too old. Once you're over, like, say, I think something like 35, they don't want your old lady eggs anymore.
That's
so
true. And she still had youth at that point. Yeah. She was young. She was spry.
I mean, believe me, if somebody wanted my eggs and they could have, I'd sell them in a heartbeat. I'm not using them.
Here's a melon baller and a a spelunker's helmet.
Did you that's Jim who said that, by the way. Did you ever consider that when you were younger?
No, I never really did.
So you don't consider it till it's too late.
I considered prostitution at one point, but there was like I didn't have an in.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because that's the thing about women is women too late do they realize the money you can make stripping. So I always tell women, I'm like, here's the thing: you just give yourself an exit point. Don't be like that girl that's just going to do it until she pays for college and then she's still there like she's 50 and she looks 90. You got to actually like set a goal. It's like it's like Vietnam. You have to go in with a clear and defined purpose, and then just don't linger endlessly. You have to. The chopper has to come at some point to get you out of Saigon.
Well, like you said, if we were a sitcom and we had a slew of writers, we would do a segment where it was girls going to talk to guidance counselors, and the guys just like, so.
You considered whoring.
Have you ever sold? You considered selling your eggs?
Well, I mean, because I mean, really, if you're not, I mean, but in general, I mean, somebody's going to use them.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's a medical procedure and whatever, but it's also like $6,000.
Yeah.
And I mean, seriously, you could pay for a lot of things with that.
Discomfort for that.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, a lot of girls put up with more than that on Friday nights when it's that, when it's they offer their boyfriend that special treat, and it's a lot of teeth gritting, for 25 minutes.
And that's just for, a movie and a couple of beers.
Exactly. So if men could do that, just like if men could hook and make thousands of dollars, they would absolutely do it.
Absolutely.
I have to tell you this. So I obviously couldn't become a whore, but I could, when I was
in your own way.
Well, I suppose.
This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine.
When I was like 18, 19,
who
there was.
Who have you worked for in the past, Rick?
Ooh, man.
There was
a
female friend that I actually did consider at one point setting up a call girl service because we had both read Mayflower Madam by Sidney Barrows, and it just seemed awesome. And our whole thing was that we were going to set up, this was when I lived in Washington State, and she was going to college, and we were going to set up a call girl service that just, it targeted, her school had a lot of Asian exchange students. A lot of guys would come over, from Japan, Korea, China, and especially, and Vietnamese guys for some reason seemed especially into statuesque blonde girls. And the whole theory was we would just specialize because she knew all of these like hot blonde chicks. And I'm like, that is money in the bank, baby. Because the thing was they're guys, so they're horny. They being an exchange student, it took a fair amount of money. And so most of them tended to come from either wealthy families or they had had money raised for them by their family or something. So it was like being a missionary. They'd raise money or they'd save for it. So they had cash to spend. They're not going to go to they're not going to squeal on you because they don't want to let the man know that they're in the country, not that they're here illegally, but they're not citizens. They're here on a student visa or whatever. They don't want to get shipped back to wherever, not because it's a bad place, but just because they're here to be an exchange student. They're not going to blow the whistle on themselves. They're not going to beef to the cheese about it. And so we figured it was like foolproof. In retrospect, I can't remember why we didn't do it. I have no recollection because it just seemed, even now, saying it out loud seems like a great idea.
My my best idea along those lines, a friend and I came up with this elaborate plan for a pornography fantasy camp, where it's basically it's like the fantasy baseball camps and stuff like that, but you are going and you're spending the weekend or the week or whatever with actual pornography directors and actors and actresses, and you get to like sort of write, direct, even act in, if you want to, your own pornographic films with porn professionals.
That would be awesome. Oh.
And I thought, you know, there is millions of dollars to be made in this idea if I could just find someone to actually fund it for
Well, they
me.
Do a thing kind of like that now because a lot of porn...
FFN, yeah.
I wasn't going to say that. I was going to say something like that, but... And this is moment. See, on a normal radio show, this is where then I would stop and I'd say, how do you know about that? And then hilarity would ensue. But of course, you know about that because...
Yeah.
Because you're a porn enthusiast.
It's my bread and butter.
They do the thing of like, porn stars will go and they'll work at like the Bunny Ranch or something and, you know, and like mm-hmm. hump it out. But yeah. they also do, there's now a whole line of movies, right, where porn stars will like find, like guys enter on their website or something and then they'll go to the guy's house and just give him a, you know, and just weave his basket.
No, well, it's a little bit more.
What is FFN?
FFN is basically.
Sounds like a diet drug.
Well, it's basically this production company, and if you are a fan of a specific actor or actress, specifically actress, you send in, you know, maybe like an essay, like, you know, why I'd like to bone, blah, 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 you know, on 400 words or less, and they send it in, and they select one person, have them screened, tested, and everything else, and then they bring him in, and they have these girls just go to town on him.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's, you know, but how do I put this? You got to figure if you're the fan... That's going to be a short movie. I mean,
do they
get multiple innings or?
Well, we have there's a lot of toys on the market. There's a lot of delaying creams.
Oh, that's true.
Basically, numbing agents in like benzocaine. Right. They give you a little bit more time, a little bit more control, as well. You know, and
spend a little bit of time with the fluffer first, and then you know, wait 15 minutes.
I'm sure they get trimmed up too, because I mean, you wouldn't want to see like, you know, some like furry plumber just like, you know, I thank you for selecting my entry. This is very much an honor to be sitting here with next to Lucy Fun Dumpster. I'm really a big fan of your work.
Fun Dumpster. I don't even know if that's a real person.
I don't think so.
All right, so now I'm obliged to ask. If you were to be the entrant, I tried to find another word for FFN. You would then pick which porn starlet?
I'd probably go with like Katsumi.
I'm not sure I know who that is. Isn't that a fruit? Isn't that like a thing? It's like a half tangerine, half grapefruit.
You're thinking of Satsuma.
Satsuma, sorry.
Yes. No, she is. She's an Asian porn star. She's got like a little bit of an accent to her. She's very, very, very pretty.
Now, do you prefer Asian women in general? Obviously, your girlfriend not Asian, but I mean, is that in your top three types?
Yeah, I would say so. I don't know. I've never dated any Asian women. I don't know. Maybe it's in your heart. What's what I can't have? You know, there's the majority of the people on the planet. I can't get one. It's like, hey, let's go have fun.
When guys come in and they're looking for the Asian porn, is that a specific kind of guy?
No, actually, we have, pornography is a good equalizer for the most part because we have, you know, rich, poor, any ethnicity you can imagine, couples, lonely guys, you know, lonely women, too, come in and rent. And there's also something that's...
Midgets? Do you get midgets?
I want to say yes. We have some very – actually, we have a very, very short gentleman that comes in on regular, you know, for the most part. But we also have interactive porn, which is basically like a woman kind of – it's very POV or point of view. And you can select from various positions and things that you'd like to sort of do. So you can sort
like
of
a
like,
choose your own adventure?
In a sense, yes. Yeah, like turn to page 14 if you like to see her take her shirt off.
I was just picturing more like Duck Hunt with a dildo in your hand. Yeah, so.
A little dog pops up and just sort of laughs at you.
Because who wouldn't find that sexy?
Seriously. I'm always intrigued by the Asian section, though, only because it's like, I was going to say they don't have that section for you to wear, but I guess they do. I guess there are sections, there's probably, it's split up into like every single possible category and niche that you can imagine.
Pretty much, yeah. We have what they call the multicultural section, which is, you know, Black, Latina, Asian.
The everybody else.
Yeah, pretty
so,
much.
Yeah. So there's white, Asian, and the rest.
It's like the Marianne and the professor
exactly.
of the porn world.
Professor.
Okay. This is the sort of question that I can't ask you because you would undoubtedly not have an answer to the which porn star or starlet would you...
I have to go back to my youth. The very first pornographic movie I ever saw. And you going to play the Waltons music there?
Yes, I am. Glad you...
The very first pornographic movie I saw was a double feature.
A condom made of bark.
At an actual pussycat theater in Los Angeles. One was not a very good movie. It was called One of a Kind, and it was about a man who owned a magical accordion. And every time someone would play the accordion, people would just start taking their clothes off and having sex. It was not a good movie.
Okay.
The other movie,
though, was called Champagne for Breakfast and starred a gentleman named Jamie Gillis, who was actually not a bad actor, and he was known for actually being funny. He was actually sort of...
Danny Kaye, if you will, of the adult world.
Dark curly hair, really good-looking guy, enormous Johnson, and did all the porn stuff, but he actually had a little bit of acting talent, and he was kind of amusing. And so I would go back in time, and I would probably have sex with Jamie Gillis.
Jamie Gillis of circa whenever that was.
Yes.
So. All right, fair enough.
Yourself, Mr. Rick Emerson?
Are we saying contemporary or retro? Or do I get to pick from the whole?
If you ever
time traveled, so why can't you?
Then I would say circa like late 70s, early 80s, I think. Late 70s, early 80s, Christy Canyon.
Oh, very nice.
Hands down, no doubt about it.
Though one of my personal favorite actresses of all time has always been Tracy Lords, not because of the fact that she had
in spite of those work.
Yeah. Because, you know, she was one that was very much sort of put in the same genre as like a Jenna Jameson or a Jessie Jane. They're very, very passionate about when they're on screen. They're not just there to kind of like be like, oh God. And there's a genuine like, you know.
Well, she's crazy, so that helps.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, to her credit, Tracy Lords has some decent acting chops. I mean, not Academy Award caliber, but, you know, I mean, you've seen her in Crybaby,
right.
A couple other films as well.
She's a serial mom, too.
Tommyknockers with, you know, Stephen King.
There was a porn actress that I really liked a lot who tried to go mainstream. She was on an episode of X-Files, I remember, and did a couple of movies named Ashlyn Gear.
Yeah.
And she was, like, not only just smoking hot, but actually, you know, pretty talented. And she made some really good porn. I mean, just, but I mean, as somebody who's really picky about porn, she made some movies that were actually genuinely hot and enthralling. You actually believed that she was enjoying herself, which is rare.
You believe
frankly.
That the hot water heater was broken in her apartment and that she had no choice but to share it with you.
I guess it's one movie that we have at my house, probably still on VHS, though, so we'll never watch it again.
We could call Patrick and ask.
I think it was called Chameleon. And I believe one of her co-stars was her then boyfriend at the time, who was also a large Germanic smoking hot actor. And their scene together was just amazing.
See, that ruins it for me. I can't, with porn, it's like if it's like in real life couple, so like I'm out. I just I have no interest in seeing a real life porn couple. The idea though
that they were actually into it though, I find much more exciting than just watching people have sex with people they barely know.
I think you are underrating the experience of having sex with people you barely know, Dawn. I think in your day that was probably. I think in your day, the idea that, you know, it was somebody they were actually into. See, but now I think if you want to see that, you can just watch full-on amateur porn.
Well, I was going to say, that's kind of why I actually have liked some somewhat amateur and semi-amateur porn for that reason.
Just a guy with, like, a camera in the corner of the room. I mean, that's if you want to see the people who are really, you know, like, into each other.
No, because there's a bunch of amateur porn that comes through my store. And a lot of times it is basically just, like, homemade stuff, but... Ultimately, the people that are doing that are exhibitionists, and a lot of times they kind of...
Play into the camera.
Yeah, they're emulating. It's a little too much, a little too over the top. So it sort of detracts from that sense. Because ideally, the whole idea behind amateur porn, I feel, is more of like a voyeurism kind of a thing. You know what I mean? With a porn movie, obviously, they've got like, you know, somewhat of a budget, somewhat of a writing staff.
Right.
Everything else. Whereas with amateur porn, it's like people that aren't actual porn stars, that don't have like the... You know, the bleached whatever, or the Brazilians and everything else. So they want to see real people having sex. And, you know, if they want that, that's, you know, ideally that's kind of boring. It's where pornography kind of comes from, is because it's over the top.
See, I'm telling you right now, Robert Wagner really missing the boat here. There should just be a porn chat show. Because they got that show that's all about iPhones.
Yeah.
And they got the show all about beer. I'm telling you. Porn talk.
Oh, God.
Just like a porn roundtable. Hey, speaking of porn and round things, have you read the story about that new Hefner book that's coming out? Not his autobiography, but this tell-all by one of the blonde... You know, one of the Legion of Blonde girlfriends that he had. It's called Bunny Tails, I think. It's a terrible name, but it's the first, like, kind of tell-all, which I am instinctively angry about. Like, without really even knowing much about it, I just got all pissed off at her. Because it's, you know, the idea that, first of all, he's like 1,000 years old. But the idea that, you know, that and apparently she's, you know, she's rather unkind to Hefner and describing, you know, even though she's clearly, like, a whore. And I mean that, like, in almost every sense of the word. Because she's upfront about the fact that she's stayed with him because as part of the Christmas present every year, he would give them the plastic surgery package of their choice. He just had an open account, and he would be like, "And what kind of plastic surgery do you want for Christmas, little girl?" And she would like, I'd like to be an E cup. All right then. And then it's like you would the next week, like you'd go off and get it done. And then every Friday, all of the girls he was then currently dating would line up, and they would come into his room one by one, and he would like. I swear to God, hidden behind a bookcase, they said, in his bedroom, he would open like this sort of Gotham bookcase and he would open a safe and then he would hand them each an envelope full of cash. And like that was their pocket money for the week. Every Friday. It was like being paid. It was like working for Kmart. You just got paid once a week in bills. And that at any given time, he dates 12 girls, apparently, one of whom is like in his bedroom all the time. Like that's where she sleeps. And the others sort of rotate through. But there's only one at a time who's sort of the bunny queen or whatever. And she basically lives with him in the bedroom. And the others sort of, and she's, I guess.
And I'm assuming that will be the one that he's marrying this time because he's engaged to the latest.
That's why it was in the news because it's coming out right as he is engaged to, I guess he proposed on Christmas Day to whatever this like 23-year-old chick is, you know, which is, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm not one to judge Hugh Hefner. It's just strange that, like, you do wonder.
I'll judge him.
This sounds strange because it's almost like we're talking about the Carlin thing again. But, you know, if you see Hefner interviewed for any length of time, even now, you know, he's a really, really whip-smart guy. I mean, he has remained very sharp. And he's done a lot for social causes and for liberalism and progressive thinking and politics. And the Playboy Foundation has funded huge amounts of First Amendment court cases over the years. And he's really made a positive impact in the world. At the same time, and he does seem that he always describes himself as being a romantic, and people laugh at that. But you got to figure he must be like when all is said and done at heart, he must be a guy who is sort of an incurable romantic. Because why would you get married three times if you're Hugh Hefner, if you're not a romantic at heart? Like if you don't believe in it in some way, you know, I don't buy that it's just because he's senile either. I mean, it's like he's got to really believe in that or there would be no point.
Yeah. And this is only, I think, what, his third marriage.
Once in the 50s before he started Playboy.
Right.
And then once with what's her name, like in the 80s, the late 80s. I forget her name. But that was where he was talking about
30-year increments.
It was I want to say Christine Hefner, but that's his daughter. But he married whoever in the 80s. And he said like, well, and I thought it was all about lots of sex with lots of women. And that's great, but I found fulfillment with something more traditional. And everybody wondered if that was going to – Kimberly Conrad Hefner was her name. And everybody wondered if that was going to last. And, he was married for like 20 years or something, and then he busted up in the early 90s, and now he's getting married again. But this new book is not too is not tremendously kind to him.
Well, either way, I mean, they could pretty much paint him with as ugly a brush as anyone.
What does he care?
Exactly. It's like it's going to be bouncing. I mean, unless they come out with like, you know, oh, by the way, turns out he's a Nazi sympathizer. And here's his gigantic pictures of him with Goebbels and everything else. Unless something like groundbreaking like that comes out, nothing is going to be able to touch that guy.
Well, you know, they're making this a great Gatsby movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. And I forget who's directing it. I want to say it's Scorsese, but I could be wrong. That seems too obvious. So I don't know if it's him or not. But it might be Darren Aronofsky. But somebody is slated to direct The Great Gatsby with DiCaprio playing Gatsby. And I always wonder why somebody doesn't just skip to the bottom of the page and just make like the Hugh Hefner story, which is very much like a real life. I mean, it's the closest we'll ever have to a real life Great Gatsby. So
I did want to mention I looked up Jamie Gillis by going back.
Of course
to
you did.
And apparently he died this year.
Oh.
Oh, no.
Now you'll never have something icky.
He still looked pretty good, though. He was 66. He still looked pretty good.
I'm trying to think if I recognize him
and
from any old school porn.
And I realized,
good looking guy though.
And I realized once again, I have such looks, a type.
Looks like Harry Shearer.
He's got a little bit Richard.
But we've talked about that whole thing I have with the high forehead and
the big nose, the
dark hair and the big noses.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, even as like a teenager experiencing my first porn. There you go.
Yeah. No. I mean, if Harry Shearer were a better looking man and a porn star, he might look a little bit like that.
I can see that.
Really white teeth on that
guy. Kind of a cross between Harry Shearer and Anthony Bourdain.
Does it know? what he died of?
It didn't say. It didn't. I missed it, so I don't.
Because that's always the thing is like when you know somebody dies of whatever, and then it's you know that's not a film you really want to watch again.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like I was wondering how
dated
those John Holmes films continue to sell when that's just creepy at this point. I mean, it's like you're watching. It's almost like you're watching some pre-snuff film. You know, like the payoff scene, the money scene is delayed 10 or 12 years, and it takes place at Cedars Sinai. But you know.
Trust me, it's more sexy than it sounds.
I'm sorry. That's the worst joke. That's the worst joke and the worst follow-up line ever in the history of the show.
Let's see, with NXS playing in the background and an episode of Hogan's Heroes.
A terrible person. Well, you know, you can buy those. You can buy Bob Crane's sex films. His son sells those.
Oh, God.
Have I never told you about this?
No.
I think you have, and I just blocked it
Hold
out.
Hold on. I got to see if Cheryl's listening. No, thank God she's not. All right. This guy says, by the way, he just said now, best show ever, and I mean that. Ever, ever, ever. And then he just writes, porn, 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 porn. Happy New Year to you, sir. Bob Crane. So Bob Crane's son, by the way, you should be warned, I have nowhere to be today, and I have no New Year's plans. So you got to tell me at some point if you need to, because I don't have anywhere to go.
It's turning into a hostage situation, Rick.
It's like a Springsteen show when he clearly had no friends and no girlfriend. You know, Bob Crane's son, Scotty Crane, and he was a grown man who went by Scotty, which tells you a lot. He did a radio show called Shaken Not Stirred. And it was, I don't think it was syndicated as such, but it was like on a couple of stations. It was like a regional show. And he, for a time, he and I worked in the same studio. He was at Hot Talk 10 at EKOTK when I first moved to Portland. And he did a weekend show, kind of a comedy, sort of a pre-prepared, like a wacky sketch comedy show on the radio called Shaken Not Stirred. It was Scotty Crane and some other guy. And I think the falling out he had with his business partner, his co-host, eventually was because he was spending too much time in the show pimping, like BobCrane.com or ScottyCrane.com, one of the two, because he had, I think after some like court case, he had won all of his dad's home sex films in like a lawsuit because I guess the stepmom wanted them and Scotty Crane wanted them. So Scotty Crane goes to court, fights to get all his dad's sex films, which is just like so disturbing.
Oh, yeah.
The judge awards him all of the sex films, and then he started this website, which I think is subsequently closed, where for like $10 a month or for like, you know, $500 as a one-time thing or whatever, like a la carte, you could just buy all of his dad's homemade hump films.
Oh, wow.
And they had little previews where you would go there and on the front page, and I totally went there. You go to the screen and there was like a little old school television graphic, and then in the middle of the screen would just be like the flickering sort of sepia-toned image of like a loop of like a sample of one of the films that would play. And it was like you would just see Bob Crane's head and then like some woman's ass moving back and forth a little bit, and then I just closed the browser. It was too weird.
See, I could never watch it because after seeing that damn movie about it, I would always think that Willem Dafoe was just off camera.
Giggling.
Smoking a cigarette slowly.
Yeah. It was all very disturbing. And I never got the gumption just to go like, what is up with you? Like, how could you, like, nobody wants to work for a living, but I mean, and it's like, did he watch them all himself or did he pay somebody to administer, did he pay somebody to run the website to watch the films and screen them, to describe them? Or did he just stick them up without even screening them, going like, whatever's on there, you know, it's yours for $10.
I mean, just imagine having like a giant cardboard box full of your dad's sex films. I mean, really.
Oh, I've told you that. Well, I've told you this story before, haven't I?
That you have?
Maybe not.
I don't think so.
Well, it wasn't about my dad. I will say that when my I will say this that when my
it's a creepy uncle story.
No, it's not. It's not that. It's a one step removed thing. This is a totally true story. That when my grandmother snuffed it, I don't know, however many years ago, when she died. My dad was like going through, because she and my grandfather split up, like I guess in the late. Mid to late 70s. And
now, is this the grandpa with like the skeleton and the Nazi
memorabilia? Yes. Had a lot of like complete skeletons in glass display cases in his in my grandmother's house. He moved out and just got this tiny little prefabricated home in the Tri-Cities, and he left basically all his stuff there, and it was still there when they both died, and they died around the same time. But yeah, when I would go to stay with my grandmother as a kid, it was called the gun room, not because there were actual guns there, though there probably were, but that's where he he was a collector of many things, including beer cans and bullets. And he had this thing where at one point he had one example, like framed, mounted of every of every kind of bullet that had ever been manufactured by an American gun company. And so it lined the walls of this room, and it was just – it was like thousands of bullets framed with little descriptions and little ID tags under them. And then glass display cases, like from a jewelry store or a candy shop, two skeletons. One – and I think they were Indian skeletons that he found down by the Columbia River. So I don't think he killed anybody for them, probably. But it was like – but that's where he found like Kennewick Man, and they were always finding Indian stuff down there. So he like found a couple. And then there was like all of the – and then there was like this red Nazi armband that as a kid, like you recognize it from being like from a war film, but like you don't process that like you shouldn't have that because A, it's illegal, and also it indicates that you're insane. And I just didn't know. But he had like a Nazi, like a Colonel Klink hat and like all of this, you know, and it's all very weird, my family. When he divorced my grandmother, he just moved out and just didn't take any of his stuff with him. So they died around the same time, and my grandfather or my dad went over to start cleaning out the back room because like you just can't have – like you can't have like the you know whoever like the guy from the Elks Lodge coming over to like clean out the house and like there's like Nazi stuff and like guns and skeletons in the back, like that's going to bring some questions about the family.
Where's Epstein going? Why is he crying? He hasn't even started yet.
So to my dad's credit, he spared our family at least until I got a radio show that shame by not. Because, like, if that happened now, you know, the news would be right there. Joe Donlan would be out front. Yeah. Like, you know, one local family found something surprising. But it's like apparently, like, he had brought, like, in the basement. We're getting totally up on here. But apparently in the basement, when he came home from the war, he had brought, like, landmines and crap with him. And it was like they were just still down there. And my dad, who had been a cop, knew some guys who worked with, like, disposal of hazardous. And he, like, called me. He's like, you can't ask any questions. He's like, please don't ask me how long I've known about this. He's like, you got to come over to my dad's house. He's dead. There's some stuff in the basement that might explode. Send some guys over. And I swear to God, they were like guys apparently. And I wasn't there, but guys came over and they had the whole like suits on and they were like taking these suspicious because he like made all his own ammunition too. He'd repack his own bullets at home. And so there's like big cases of black powder. And the whole thing was just insane.
Good
Lord. But at one point, so my dad – and this is where, by the way, I was left to play all the time as a kid. And they all knew that stuff was there. It's not like it was a mystery.
It's like a serial killer starter kit.
I remember just going in and just like just poking around in all of this stuff when I was a little kid. And they just didn't think anything of it. It's just insane when you think about it. But after they died, it's like my dad took me over one day because he was like starting to take boxes of some of the less explosive things like out to the truck, to the dump or whatever. And we had a huge landfill that was just a huge hole in the ground. No government regulation. It was like behind the Knights of Columbus Lodge. And you could just dump anything in. Nobody would ever find it again. And and that's where people would just dump stuff they didn't want to have to, like, explain. And it was right behind the Knights of Columbus Hall in Richland, Washington. It was a huge, huge landfill where there was no questions asked. And so he just started taking box after box of stuff there. And he, like, left me alone for, like, half an hour at one point while he went to dump stuff or went to go get beer or something. And
because you're going to need some.
And I'm just – and I'm – 7, maybe 8, I guess. I don't know how old I would have been, but old enough to kind of process things a little bit. And I was like rooting around and like in this big pile of stuff because it's like fascinating when you're a kid. It's like all this cool thing. And I found – this is so horrible. And I found this like whole – I found this whole box of like porn photos of my grandfather, my grandmother.
Oh, yeah.
And then like other people – other people that, you know, like other men, other women, one of whom I recognized as being like a close friend of my grandfather's that my dad occasionally spent time with, you know, like one of the old, like the old guy, he was a friend of Pop's, you know, and he and I'll get together for a beer now and again, this guy named Lyle. And my dad and Lyle would occasionally get together at the lodge at the Knights of Columbus Hall, mm-hmm. and they'd raise a brew to the old man or whatever. And it's like, and so my dad like spent time with Lyle. And so I'm looking through these photos and it's like, there's my dad or there's my grandfather, there's my grandmother, there's Lyle. And then there's like another woman who may have been like Lyle's wife. I have no idea. And I remember just like staring at it, not really processing what it was. I just have this one image, which I will not describe, burned into my memory like forever. And it was at that moment, I swear to God, that like my mom appeared. And it was like the whole sitcom thing of like, so what are you? Oh, my God. And she reached and she like took it away from me and, you know, like put it in another room. And she's
here,
like,
play with this landmine.
Yeah.
This never happened.
And it's like, and here's the horrible thing, like the really awful thing that I sort of feel bad about to this day. It's like the day that I was like 4 and I pulled all my sister's weed out of her purse because I didn't know what it was. was, and my parents didn't know that she smoked weed. And so I just was like stringing it all over the living room because I was like a little kid. I was just like a toddler or something, and I just like pulled it. And my parents came in, and like there's their small child like playing with a bunch of marijuana. And they booted my sister out of the house, and I've always felt guilty about that. Because it's like, I didn't know. I was just like fooling around in her purse. I was a little kid and I just pulled all this marijuana out. And she lords that over me every now and again that like I got her kicked out of the house. My dad apparently did not know these photographs existed. He had just started stacking boxes like in like a small little anteroom, like, you know, prior to taking them out. Like he hadn't looked into it. He was just taking boxes from the basement, sticking them upstairs, and then was like gradually taking them onto the truck. He hadn't looked inside. And so I was the one who discovered these. And so my mom, of course, then felt like she had no choice but to like tell my dad about it so he could be on the lookout for more of it. So I was the one who inadvertently revealed to my father the fact that like his parents had made all of these porn movies and pictures and whatever with like his pal Lyle. And it was just like so. And my mom tried to explain it to me later.
Did your dad keep hanging out with Lyle?
I don't think so. And all I remember is that even from my dad's standards, he got colossally wasted that night, like unbelievably. I mean, and the bar was set high for my dad in drunkenness, but he got like unbelievably blitzed that night.
But that's like, seriously, that's like getting one of the Bob Crane videos and seeing Richard Dawson kind of like in the background.
It's horrifying. And apparently he did like the Leaving Las Vegas thing of like he got all plowed and then went into their backyard and started like, he had like a fire, you know, for like our compost or whatever, and like went and burned them all in our backyard, because I guess that's what you did with that stuff then, because you don't take it to the landfill, because that'll be the day that somebody's rooting around inside looking for a pair of shoes. Isn't this your grandmother? You shut up about my grandmother, you know? So anyway, it's just the worst. And in retrospect, like I remember the other thing that my grandfather was a man of, and then we really should just go home, but because God only knows what I'll say next.
Yeah, really.
Tell us more, Uncle Rick.
He was a man of many interests, not just Nazi memorabilia and dead Indians. He also, if you
bullet enthusiast, swinger.
If you went into the attic, he also practiced. He was a hunter, so he practiced a little taxidermy, and they were the. This was fascinating.
Are you serious?
I swear to God.
And that's what happened to Lyle's wife, by the way.
When I was a kid, I would go up and he would like, and again, when he moved out, I guess my grandmother kicked him out one day and said like, you're never coming back. So like a lot of stuff was just as he had left it like 20 years before.
I wonder after all of that, what was the actual like tipping point in the relationship?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, the Nazi stuff I can handle. The skeletons, I'm fine. The swinging, the bullets,
the
I'm okay with
in
all
the
of
basement.
That.
In the
but I will not let you bake. you stay out of my kitchen.
In the attic with the taxidermy stuff, there were actually just drawers full of, they were fake, but just drawers full of prosthetic eyes, like fake eyes for like, you know, because you mount the deer in the eyes, you know, I guess they don't last or whatever.
Yeah.
And so you'd have like fake. So that's great when you're a kid because you just see drawers full of like big googly deer eyes looking up at you that are just like by themselves.
That's good old fashioned nightmare material.
It was almost like I Sing the Body Electric or something like they were. But
like your own grandma.
But along with the taxidermy stuff in the attic, like he had, there was a light switch on the wall that always was puzzling to me because it didn't look like the other light switches. It was black and there was a red light above it. And that was apparently a dark room. And now you know the rest of the story. So that all tied together when I was older. I went dark room, sex, Lyle. Oh.
Yeah, because you don't send those down to the drugstore.
Right. So anyway.
With the vacation photos.
I need a box of rubbers and are my pictures finished?
It just explains like so much about like my dad and my family. And it's like why people grew up to be the way that they did, you know, on that side of things anyway. I mean, it's just, you know.
I have this feeling like somewhere in part of town, there's a police officer listening, kind of like a la The Usual Suspects. He's dropping a cup of coffee. He's like,
yeah,
all these
all
boys coming together. He's running for
Lyle.
His
they're just looking up Rick's address and putting a red pin in the map because they know that someday that they will need to go there.
Removing Lyle as the capo and then putting Rick's picture up there at the top.
They'll be doing some excavating in my front yard. Are we just going to go out on that, really? Okay, that's fine.
We can't top it.
No, we'll end. All right,
so
it's Happy New Year, everyone. Well, we might as well just get it out this year.
Yeah, we
leave
rang
it behind.
Out 2010 for every last drop.
Well,
so next year there'll be none of this.
We'll be.
We used up all the porn talk and the crazy Nazi grandpa stuff.
I would like to think that this is the first show that some of our subscribers are hearing, that like maybe as a gift for the holidays they received a subscription to the Rick Emerson Show. I can't wait. I love that Legion of News show where they work clean. Let's see what else they do. He says no profanity, so it must be friendly for the whole family.
Come on, kids. We're going to listen to a new radio show.
God damn. All right. So I'll move Greatest Songs Ever Till Monday. We'll do that on Monday. We'll also talk to Mr. Ryan White, music editor from The Oregonian. Jim Willick, we'll talk more about your upcoming show at the Baghdad. You were just did you say what you were doing for New Year's? You're just hanging out? You have plans?
I got a friend's house we're going to go to and spend the night there and just get boldly out of control.
Awesome. So
it must be nice to have friends who invite you to do things on New Year's.
I wouldn't know. You're looking at the wrong man.
I didn't get anything
either. You know, it's like did you say that David Walker said that, you know, the problem with turning people down is eventually they quit inviting you?
Yeah, he said I got to start going to things because otherwise people are going to stop inviting me to anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, like, and it's
apparently
like,
I've reached that point.
And then I get pissed off because I'm not invited to anything, you know? but I love that movie, you know? I guess they don't want to, you know?
I would have come to dinner and hung out with all those other people that I know.
See, and that part's a lie, though.
You didn't invite me.
See?
That's not true. If someone invited me to a lovely dinner party with others, I would go.
Oh, see.
I would totally go.
See, for me, that's, I know exactly. That's why I did stop getting invited to certain things, because I would be like, yeah, I'll try to do that, which, of course, is like, that's when your mom says, I'll think about it, and like, it never happens. So you are spending the night with friends. Don will be at home. I'll be at my home and just trying to do almost nothing.
Developing film.
Yeah, exactly. If you notice any white smoke.
I'll be looking for my old Jamie Gillis and Ashland Gear VHS tapes.
If you see anything cloudy coming out of my eyes, it just means we picked a new pope. There's nothing to worry about there. So in any
case, Duralock smells weird.
As we wrap up this year, and we said this during Legion of News, and I was again, and Greg and Sarah were talking about this yesterday as well, that it is if you think about everything that probably for a lot of us, I mean, has changed from last year to this year, and then how different next year might be from this year. And this is where, as Todd Werkhoven used to say, this is where he would occasionally send me a little message that said, Rick Emerson now switching on maudlin mode. I do want to take a moment. We read the email earlier from the guy that went to Squires Electric, and he said he never would have known about it, if not for our show. So we want to thank, first of all, everybody, all the business partners we've had this year. Some of the people who came on, people who came on like from almost the first day with, I'm not going to say they had no reason to believe in the show, but I mean, it's a different type of show and a different iteration of the show. And so, everybody, whether it's the cleaning solution or whether it's a CJ's High Climbing or whether it's a New Millennium Landscaping and Maintenance or Squires Electric or Castalia Language Center or Christmas Mountain Trees, or I know I'm forgetting somebody right now, so you should be helping me out
I don't
shame everyone and bring failure on us. There was Sorrell's Vintages.
Sorrell's Vintages?
That may in fact be it, and if it's not,
CJ's
I feel like
it's High Climbing,
yes,
right?
Yeah, so yeah, I feel like an ass if there's somebody else. Yeah. But mugshotlist.com,
right?
So everybody who has believed in the show from the outset, so that does mean a great deal, and also and really no fooling to the listeners, because it's just. Not to be, not to go on and on about this, because we said this a lot when we first started, and I've said it a few times since then. But I think that probably everybody, and even even to a certain degree us, we were unclear about whether or not this would work, because especially this show, because we do Legion of News, which is great. We want to thank Cascadia.fm and Robert Wagner and those guys for for giving us the slot for Legion of News. But also, I think it was a little bit of a question mark as to how this show and doing the thing of like, hey, we don't want to be canceled again. And so, the only people who should cancel the show should be the listeners. And so for that reason, it's going to be a subscription show, and it's going to be, it's going to be a couple bucks a month. And it's and there were a lot of questions about whether it would work or how it would work. And the only reason it does work is because people listen and they enjoy it and they tell other people about it. And so that does not ever, if you think about where, what you were doing a year from now, and I don't really even know. I mean, maybe, you've always got a lot of irons in the fire, but your life was certainly different a year ago.
Yeah. And I want to thank you for approaching me and talking to me about this venture and pulling me into this in the first place. Because, I was doing the Ham-Fisted Radio podcast, but I was kind of afloat and trying to figure out what my next thing would be. And it turned out that this was that next thing. And it has been absolutely life-changing in every single way.
It really has worked out. Well, and you obviously, you're a huge part of that. I mean, it's just, it's like in the, Now it always sounds like everything becomes a compliment for me again. But I had this sense. And from our very first conversation about
kid, I'll make you a star.
From our first conversation, which I think was like nine conversations before you finally just asked me whether or not I was asking you to join the show because I was passively not coming out with it. You and I have always been very much on the same page about a lot of things. You know, from I think actually your first appearance on the show, like, you know, the last version of the show. So it's so I want to thank you for saying yes, actually, and for not just saying like, that's a stupid idea, you know, and just which I think you would have been entitled to do at that point. For tolerating my juvenile inanity, you know, every day. So thank you. And to Cheryl Kanakoa, you know, who really is like the linchpin of this entire operation.
Absolutely.
Without him, we would just flail.
Yeah, invaluable.
Yeah. And Bruce Agler, who along with Cheryl tracks, you know, helps to track the money and to track all, you know, the incoming and the outgoing and the numbers and the figures and just the minutiae and the statistics of like, you know, what needs to be signed and when and what needs to go where and what license needs to be obtained for what band and what kind of music clearance we need for whatever, which all of which we would be incapable of doing on our own.
Yeah. In many ways, they are the grown-ups allowing us to do our juvenile little thing that we do here every day.
I mean, if we were left to our own devices without Bruce and Cheryl for like even a month, I mean, this whole thing would just implode. It never would have launched. I'll put it that way. It never, ever, ever would have gotten off the ground if it hadn't been for those guys. So, anyway, just a thanks to all of you guys. And as we head into the new year, thank you for listening and continue to spread the word. And it means a great deal to us.
And I do want to say, I do totally understand now why you have always said that they are the best audience ever. I had no idea what it was like to have people like this behind me and in my court and sending me emails and texts and bringing me Christmas presents, for God's sake. You guys out there, you really are the best audience ever.
They are quite unlike any audience that I at least have ever known or encountered, you know, or even heard of, really. So I say it all the time because it's true and because it does manifest itself all the time in a myriad ways. So thank you to all you guys. Have a great New Year's and be safe and sound and happy and all that. And we will see you again Monday, January 3rd, 2011. I will not be that guy that says see you next year. Jim Willig, happy New Year to you as well.
As well, you too, guys. And, be safe.
All right, we're going to do a brief musical interlude here. We'll have today's Legion of News episode encoring, after which a encore of this very fine radio program. And I'll be doing that all week. Along with some other things from the archive. So thank you for listening. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, who we also have to thank, as well as our friend Seamus in Colorado. You're part of the geek trifecta that helped get us off the ground and helps keep us running with all
Indeed.
Things.
Indeed.
Our executive producer, Bruce Agler, chief of staff, Cheryl Kanakoa, the Rick Emerson Show made possible by our business partners and by a generous grant from you. It is December 31st, 2010, New Year's Eve, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, as always, thank you for listening. See you Monday. Be safe. Bye now.